So they're all coming here.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to convene the interim session of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, September 16th, 2014. We're in order. Welcome to all of you. We have a full house today, which is obvious. And because of that, it will be or may be difficult for all questions to be answered and for everyone to have as much time as he or she would like. We have invited testimony only today, and we have some very, very heavy-duty subjects that we're going to be covering. Because of that, we're going to have to adhere to a very strict time limit of, depending on which topic we're on, 2 to 3 minutes per person. My apologies to you in advance, but we have no other way of getting through our agenda without that kind of strict adherence. If the committee members have additional questions that we are unable to get to from any of the folks that will be appearing today, please write down your questions, hand them into Beth, and she will get those answered for you. If the public has questions that you would like to have responded to, we will entertain those as well, and you can pass those in over here to the committee assistant, okay? Right here. And with that, we beg everyone's indulgence to help us get through this this very strenuous agenda. And please, at all times, be cognizant of one fact. We are all Oregonians, and we must all respect each other's opinions. We may not agree with everyone, but as citizens of this state, we can do it better than anybody else. Please remember, these are your friends and neighbors. With that, Beth, some housekeeping?
Yeah, just two quick things. Members, you've probably already heard about the new recording system. So just to be aware that when the blue light is on, the recording system is functioning. When it's not on, it's not. It will no longer flash like it used to when it was being paused. And then second piece of housekeeping, and you've probably already heard about this, Committee Services has just updated all of their background briefs. So if you are interested in, I'll be happy to help you find them on the website or provide you with copies, whatever you'd like. So it's a couple little housekeeping items.
Thanks very much. For everyone in the audience, I think typically we hear in terms of forest products and the industry, that mills close down, that we have a lot of people who have or are losing jobs, that we are facing litigation, both for and against the harvest of timber in this state, that folks are unable to get along, that we've paralyzed oftentimes the management of our forests. And I am pleased today that we are going to be taking a look at forest health, and I suspect giving you a very different paradigm than what we have been reading about and hearing about in the media. With that, I would like to call forward, please, State Forester Doug Decker, Brett Brownscombe, and Chad Davis. Welcome to each of you. And some exciting things to talk about this afternoon.
All right. And so we begin, and we will be mindful of the time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. We're going to focus in on forests and forest health, particularly as it relates to federal forests today. I'm pleased to be joined by a number of folks, some who are here and others who will rotate up here in a few moments, who have people who have helped us shape the state's approach to increasing the pace and scale of management on Oregon's national forest lands. You'll recall that the state of Oregon, through ODF, is working intently with local communities and with federal agencies to improve the management, the resiliency of federal forests in Oregon. We refer to this as the Collaborative Support Package, or the 2.88. You may have heard that. That's $2.88 million of lottery funds that we've been investing in some very specific ways that Chad's going to describe for you here in a moment that we think are making a real difference for rural Oregon communities. Our goal in the 30 minutes that we have, if we can take that time, is to update you on the impact of the work. And I'm going to start out by talking about why it's important, why this matters to Oregon, and then putting it in context with some new tools that Oregon has in place to work with the federal forest management agencies. So for me, I want you to know why this is important, and I would start with the first slide is that 60% of Oregon's forest lands are 30 million, there's 60% of our 30 million acres of forest lands are owned and managed by the federal government. And they're managed to achieve goals and outcomes that are that have been defined by Congress and that have been enacted in a set of federal rules that are translated by the federal agencies into management plans. And the work that we're going to describe today of the 2.88 is really all within the context of those existing federal authorities, the National Forest Management Act, the National Environmental Policy Act. So this is within those existing authorities. The state of Oregon is preparing a set of recommendations about ways to modernize some of these authorities. And that's another conversation. We've begun that with our Board of Forestry, with the Governor's Office, and with a growing number of interests at the national level. And so that's this is really kind of playing within the existing authorities that are out there. And so here's the problem. We have a complicated confluence of conditions and choices and policies that has led to a situation in which much of Oregon's federal forest, not all of it, but much of it, particularly in eastern Oregon, is in a compromised condition. And we see that through fire, through the infestations of insects and disease, where it's vulnerable there. This next slide will show you a picture of forest ownership. The colors are different ownership types. And yellow on this map is private industrial forest land. The green lands are Oregon's federal forest lands. And the red lands are lands that are owned by Oregon's family forest landowners, typically smaller landowners. You can see that the Cascades, southwest Oregon, and much of eastern Oregon are owned and managed by the federal government. And so these lands that are federally owned represent a significant value and potential in terms of habitat.
What right do they have control of so much of our land here?
Sir, please. I'm going to ask everyone to please recognize that when we have folks up here testifying, they have the microphone, and I'm going to ask that the public please not interrupt. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Brad. So the lands, these federal lands, really represent significant value, social, economic, and environmental value, habitat, jobs, products, recreation, all the things that we want from multiple-use managed forests. But there's been a set of legal challenges, of congressional gridlock, of hotly debated public opinion, and really some outdated policies that have conspired to produce a set of conditions on these lands that not only do not leverage the potential that they represent, but they actually work against rural communities that are striving to survive, and in many cases also export risks to adjacent non-federal forest lands as well. So the state working through the governor's office, the Board of Forestry, working with local communities and collaboratives, and with your leadership, we've been thinking about how we can make a difference here, and that's what we want to talk with you about today. So Brett is going to tell us a little bit about from the governor's standpoint. Chad is going to talk through how we've been investing the 2.8. And then I'm going to close. I'll come back after we have some of our other colleagues join us with a sense of this, some new authorities that we have through the federal farm bill called Good Neighbor Authority. I hope we're going to define the way we work with the federal agencies in 1517.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Welcome, Brett.
Thank you, Chair Witt, and members of the committee. Thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Brett Brownscombe, Natural Resource Policy Advisor to the Governor. And what I wanted to start with, and I'd like to be brief, is in deference to the remaining presenters, is just a bit about the Governor's perspective on why this issue over federal forest management remains such an important one. Many people, if not most people in Oregon, probably can't name the national forests that exist within the state, or certainly the BLM districts within the state. But most people have their lives affected whether they realize it or not, often by what happens on these lands and the conditions on these federal forest lands, which, as Doug pointed out, dominate the landscape acreage within the state as shown on the map. So what I'd like to do is rattle off some examples of how the public is affected and what the various members of the public are who are affected by federal forest management. And these are based on real-world examples of people who live in House districts such as yours or Senate districts, Senator, that I've come across in the past 2 to 3 years. And so, first there's the rural resident whose community is directly adjacent to federal forest lands and who has seen decreases in school enrollment or decreases in local jobs, generally related to either the idling or closure of mills in their community. Then there's the resident of places like John Day or Klamath Falls or towns in the Willamette Valley like yesterday who wonder whether they should send their kid to school or whether they should spend too much time outdoors because of excessive levels of smoke in the air due to wildfire often burning on federal lands. Or there's the school board member or the superintendent or the local rural hospital director who is looking at an opportunity to reduce energy costs by converting from fossil fuel sources, heating oil sources, to woody biomass that has a connection to supporting forest health. There's also the tree-hugging environmentalist or the hunter who, like many people in the general public, want to know that they can find a place where they can find solitude or recreate in a place with wild habitat that supports healthy fish and wildlife populations that they can't find in urban environments, or people who just want to know that places like that exist within our state. There's also the mill owner, the mill worker, the logger, the building architect in some of the urban sectors, or the traded commodities worker who are looking at the next opportunity or wondering whether there will be potential future economic opportunities tied to federal forest management, or the Portland resident who just had their Rogue River float trip canceled because they could no longer access the put in due to smoke from wildfire, or the Sisters Oregon business owner who had their inventory of clothing wiped out because they can't wash the smoke from the fabric after wildfire. And finally, there's the state, not to mention the national taxpayer, who is seeing increasing general fund and millions in increasing general fund payments for fire suppression costs. So the first point here is that this is not just a rural issue, but this is a statewide issue, and it affects citizens of many stripes, whether they live adjacent to federal lands or not. The current conditions on these lands are expose or threaten all of the above interests that I mentioned. And addressing these underlying causal conditions with proactive management is really key to finding solutions on the symptoms that are evidenced by the examples that I rattled off. The second point is that this is not just an issue of challenge, but also an issue of opportunity. And we'll hear more about this in a minute from Chad and Tom Insko, who came from afar. But the broad point here is that this is an issue that connects across economic, social, and ecological values, and it can produce the elusive common ground for diverse, often competing interests, and it can provide that often sought-after triple bottom line solution in a way that other issues don't always do. The issue has ties to the governor's and the first lady's interests around advancing rural prosperity, but it also connects to Oregon prosperity writ large. And it connects to our cultural identity, both past and present and future. So importantly, Oregon is a leader in this on this issue, and with growing recognition nationally. Our history has been tied to the storyline around the timber wars, and that's our most recent history on this issue. But it's really been because of our locally grown efforts to move beyond that tired storyline of the timber wars through collaboration that we are now gaining national recognition. We now have three national forests statewide where there's not been litigation in 7 years because of the work of local forest collaborative groups. And our leadership is also, as a state, is also based on your leadership as a legislative body, as demonstrated by the advancement of the a new form of constructive partnership with federal management agencies, as demonstrated through the, as well as local communities and local forest collaborative groups, that was demonstrated in 2013 with the investment of $2.85 million in enhancing the pace and scale of federal forest management work, which I know Chad will talk about. So to wrap up, building on this momentum is very much in the governor's interest because he believes it connects to many facets of the state's interests across economy, communities, and environment. I know he looks forward to working together with the legislature and across party lines to advance the next round of solutions and Oregon leadership steps on this issue. And lastly, I wanted to mention the governor recently became vice chairman of the Western Governors Association, which puts him in line to become chair of the association in 2015, late 2015. I know in that capacity, he's looking forward to working with other Western governors on federal forest management policy and doing what he can to increase the space, the policy space that we have to build momentum around the positive examples that we have going right now for us, but also increase that space to enhance what we can do. And that does involve broader policy conversations with a community at the national level that Western governors are ideally positioned to influence. So with that, I'll close and stick around for any questions, but probably step in the back so that Tom Insko can come up, and just want to thank you for the invitation.
Brett, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your appearance.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chad Davis, and over at the Department of Forestry, I serve as the project manager on the state legislature's investment in federal forest health. I'm appreciative of this opportunity today to report on how we focus the state's investment to strengthen collaborative agreement for active management on federal forests and to increase the pace and scale of forest health treatments. At the highest level, our strategy is targeted and based on a premise that a strong federal and state partnership can meaningfully improve the status quo of forest management across the state. And our strategy is leveraged both in terms of commitment, as evidenced by the Forest Service's willingness to partner with the state in this regard, and in terms of its funding, as evidenced by their obligation of an additional $10 million of federal funds in the same geographic region as the state's focus. As a result of the state's investment, the federal investment, and the targeted approach being employed, local forest collaboratives are maturing and increasing the scope of their agreements. For one example is the Blue Mountain Forest Partners, based out of John Day, that are using a state-awarded grant to retool their collaborative process to match the increased pace and scale of management happening on the Malheur National Forest. Secondly, the Forest Service is refining its approach to project-level planning, and this effort is buoyed by state investments. The Forest Service's regional office made a 3-year commitment, and that started last year, to fund a dedicated planning team for larger-scale projects in the Blue Mountains region. State funds are being strategically used to leverage even more process change within this particular team's purview. The planning team's first project is a 90,000-acre project called Lower Joseph Creek Project in Wallowa County. We expect a decision on that project in December of this year. On Lower Joseph, state funds are being used to complete heritage resource surveys. With our federal partners, we have identified this survey protocol in particular for potential cost and time reductions. The planning team is also charged to deliver two other projects over the next 2 years, the second of which is a 500,000-acre project due in 2016. State funds are in play to support this very large-scale project as well. Finally, all of the combined efforts, including public and private investments, are changing the direction of important metrics such as local employment and timber availability. As shown on this chart on the screen, we are seeing a significant increase in timber availability, in particular here as shown on the Mount Hear National Forest, compared to what they've produced over the last 10 years. In this regard, state funds are being used to help conduct pre-sale layout activities for projects that have already cleared environmental analysis, realizing that there is an additional needed capacity to get those projects, quote-unquote, off the shelf. The volume of timber actually awarded, as indicated by the yellow line on this graph, has increased in each of the last 3 years. This includes an almost 200% increase from 2012 to 2013 due to the award of a 10-year stewardship contract. Just 2 years ago, Malheur Lumber Company had announced it would close due to a lack of supply. Today, that mill is buying logs, and it has indicated an intent to reinvest to improve its milling capacity in the area. While difficult to plot as an empirical relationship with this increase in timber supply, unemployment in Grant and Harney counties declined by 1% from July of 2013 to July of 2014. That decline outpaces what we've seen across the entire state. Given the short window in response time for these more bulky metrics, anecdotal evidence makes a much stronger case about the positive impacts within the local economy of this work. I encourage each of you to call a store owner in Grant County and ask them for yourselves. At this point, I'm going to hand this over to Mr. Tom Insko, who can speak to the opportunities that these combined state and federal investments are yielding for the forest sector.
Mr. Insko, welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you for making yourself available. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Witt, committee members, my name is Tom Insko. I'm the Inland Area Manager for Boise Cascade, and as Doug mentioned, I also serve on the State Board of Forestry. Chad's mentioned some important metrics, primarily focused on the ground. We obviously have a significant issue there, but also in business, robust performance metrics tied to meaningful outputs is a primary method for monitoring success. I think it's a perfectly legitimate question to ask, how have the $2.8 million, what kind of return on investment have we had? And I would suggest it's significant, because not only has the state leveraged federal partnerships, but private partnerships are also being leveraged. And to provide some context in terms of where we were literally when this investment was first made, just a few years ago, industry was nearly in collapse in eastern Oregon. Malheur Lumber had announced closure. And I was literally in the process of analyzing how we would essentially exit all but one of our facilities. Mm-hmm. To put that in perspective, today, Boise Cascade employs 650 employees in eastern Oregon. So a huge switch in terms of where we were directionally going and where we are today. I wouldn't suggest there aren't challenges. There are thorns on the roses that we're seeing out there, and that just illustrates the importance of continued investment and diligence in this case. Currently, Boise Cascade is adding jobs and investing in operations in eastern Oregon due in part to the leadership and investment of the state. Recently, I testified here in Salem that we had added 70 jobs at our lumber mill in LeGrand and our particle board plant outside of Island City. We're also making significant investments at our Elgin facility. We just completed a phase of a two-phase project that will be fully completed mid-year next year, represents $15 million of capital investment, and it's a new approach for creating a partnership with the federal forest and what we need to do out there. What it will allow us to do is take material off the forest, not just federal, but across all ownerships, to a 2-inch top. So material that would have historically been left in the woods, we are going to keep attached to saw log. We can scan that, we can merchandise it, we can take that wood to the proper place, whether it be chipping it,
or taking it into an existing mill infrastructure. The value in that really is, yes, we've got $15 million of capital investment, but if you look at those mills that we have in Eastern Oregon, they really represent hundreds of millions of dollars of installed investment. And today, four of those five mills aren't running at full capacity. So we've got opportunity, and with that installed capacity, we can add an additional 150 jobs in Eastern Oregon. So the trend is positive, but I would suggest that we need to continue to invest, we need to continue to be diligent, and the state needs to continue to take a leadership role in forming new partnerships with the federal owners in Oregon. Last but not least, I want to stress that there is the need for policy reform, and we'll continue to work on that, too, as we go forward. So in closing, I just want to thank this committee. I want to thank the governor. I want to thank the staff and all those that are working diligently to really change the tide in rural Oregon and with Forest Health in Eastern Oregon and across the state. Thank you.
Mr. Insko, thank you very, very much. And again, I apologize for the brevity that we have you before us, but such is the nature. Give us the take-home message.
Well, the take-home message is the trend lines are going in the right direction. There is a ton more work to do, and some of the new tools that we have are going to set the stage for the next couple of years. We've gained an authority called the Good Neighbor Authority within the Federal Farm Bill, which allows state foresters, with an agreement in place with the federal agencies, to actually manage a project on federal land to accomplish those objectives that have gone through that process. So what we're thinking about and we'll be talking with you more about in the full session is a package that would allow us to essentially double the investment and further increase the pace and scale of restoration on federal forest land.
Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. And your message is one of hope. Thank you for your hard work. We look forward to hearing from you more about this here in the future.
We'd love to bring a topic back related to biomass.
We will be looking forward to hearing that.
Thank you.
All right, I'd like to call forward, please, Thomas Royick and Palmer Mason, please.
Do you want to do all of this? Yes. Do you want to do it all?
Okay, all right, fine.
Great.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. We will look forward to your presentation during the full session. I appreciate your helping us with the clock. We just gained 5 minutes. Thank you. With that, we're going to switch gears and move from Forest Health to the lead ammunition survey. And I preface this by saying that there's been a great deal of discussion about the possibility of our state banning lead ammunition, and there's been, it's not surprising, a rather controversial issue, of which a number of us on this committee have been receiving a great deal of communication from the general public. 1 hour ago, I had, at that point, I had received 170 emails. So it's suggestive of how important this is to the general public, and we're looking forward to hearing more about what may or may not be proposed. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Roy Elliker and Ron Anglin. Yes, Vice Chair Esquivel, please.
Before the panel gets in place, I would like to add that I've received almost 200 emails on banning of lead.
Right. Gentlemen, before you begin, sir, a little unorthodox, but I understand that you may have a question or something.
Well, I'll tell you, the lead issue is why I'm here, but I don't think it's proper to go on to the last subject about the forest without some input from the public on that.
Okay. We're here for an informational hearing. That's what this is all about. And we're receiving that information to assist us in helping to determine whether or not we may be entertaining certain pieces of legislation in the regular session. Based on the information that we received today, that may sway some of us or not. You will have, and the rest of the public will have, more than adequate opportunity during the legislative session to testify. And I'm sorry, sir, but I'm going to have to cut the public off. We have to move forward. My apologies. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for making yourselves available. Please give us your views on the lead ammunition survey and whatever background that you might have for the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, though, I would like to take a few minutes to speak about another matter. What's that?
Identify yourself.
Oh, yes. For the record, my name is Roy Elker, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you.
And before I start my prepared comments, which were passed out to the committee, thank you. Before I start my prepared comments, I would like to preface my testimony that I think all of you know that I'm leaving this position and going to the Fish and Wildlife Service and work on fisheries. And I wanted to come forward, and Mr. Chair, I'm appreciative of the time frame, but it'd be remiss if I did not thank this committee for all their help and support in the years that I have been in this building on fish and wildlife issues. And the appreciation of the many things I have learned about the business of governance from the members of this committee and others in the legislature, as well as the support for the department and for its policies, and for the passion that all the members of this committee bring to fish and wildlife management in Oregon. And I've never disagreed with the vice chair, Representative Esquivel. But, Mr. Chair, it's a bittersweet moment for me. Friday's my last real day on the job, and then I'll be moving out of state government into federal government, where I hope I can bring the viewpoints of many of you into some of the federal processes. At least I'm hoping that's why they asked me to come join them when they
did.
So, again, I just want to thank this committee for all their help through the years, both individually and collectively. I've had many mentors on this committee and outside this committee. Many folks have come and gone. All have been very helpful to me, and I want to thank each and every one of you. So thank you.
Well, Roy, and this committee thanks you for your service. You have always made yourself available, not only to this committee, but to the general public. I know that personally that you love the resources that you managed, and we have been in most capable hands under your leadership and guidance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now to my prepared testimony on the lead ammunition survey. I'll just take a couple minutes, but I do want to put this on the record, Mr. Chair. In June 2014, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon State University Wildlife Extension Unit began surveying Oregon hunters regarding their opinions and attitudes about lead ammunition, available alternatives, and strategies used in other locations to reduce the use of lead ammunition. A survey of the non-hunting public is currently underway as well. The survey effort was prompted due to the increasing effort to restore California condors throughout their historic range, which includes portions of Oregon. California condors have been the subject of an intensive, high-profile recovery effort since the 1980s, when the condor population dwindled to just 22 birds. An intensive captive breeding program was initiated, including a facility operated by the Oregon Zoo. In 1992, condors were re-released in California and in Arizona in 1996 by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. More recently, the service began discussions with the Yurok Tribe of Northern California regarding a release site on tribal land south of the Oregon border. A memorandum of understanding was signed in March of this year, setting the stage for potential releases in Northern California in the near future. According to the Fish and Wildlife Service, the primary cause of condor mortality is lead poisoning, with lead ammunition as the primary source. The service states that while other lead exposure sources may exist, for instance, paint chips, science has clearly shown that condors are primarily exposed to lead by ingesting lead shot or fragments of lead bullets when feeding on carcasses. Lead rifle bullets fragment to hundreds of tiny pieces when they strike an animal and are left behind in the gut pile. And those are quotes from the service. According to the Fish and Wildlife Service documents, this threat and others must be addressed in a meaningful way in any proposal to reintroduce condors. The service uses the California legislation banning the use of lead ammunition for hunting as an example. Voluntary programs in Arizona and Utah are also identified as successful strategies to reduce condor exposure to lead ammunition. These voluntary programs, supported by a coalition of state and federal agencies, non-governmental organizations, industry, and retailers, include ammunition exchanges, incentives, education programs, and other efforts to encourage hunters to voluntarily switch to non-lead ammunition in areas where condors are present. California condors are far-ranging and are known to fly as much as 150 miles a day in search of food. As a result, any condors released in Northern California can be expected to appear in Southern Oregon, where they will have full protection of the Federal Endangered Species Act. In addition, there is interest by tribes and other organizations to see California condors reintroduced in Oregon. Once condors appear in Oregon, department expects that the state will be required to take some action to reduce condor exposure to lead. The department expects advocacy groups to pursue litigation or propose legislation or a ballot measure to completely ban or significantly restrict the use of lead ammunition for hunting. During the past few years, advocacy groups like the Center for Biological Diversity have repeatedly filed lawsuits or petitions challenging the use of lead ammunition, especially in areas frequented by condors. Similar legal challenges can be expected when condors appear in Oregon. An outright ban on the use of lead ammunition for hunting could have a significant impact on hunting, wildlife management, and ODFW funding. Hunting is an important tool for managing wildlife populations. Additionally, revenue from the sale of hunting and fishing licenses and the related federal excise tax on firearms, ammunition, fishing rods, tackle, and other equipment provides more than 40% of the department's funding. Without this funding, the department would be unable to fulfill its statutory responsibility to manage Oregon's fishing rights for the use and enjoyment of present and future generations. Because of the significant potential impact of this issue, ODFW collaborated with the Oregon State University to survey hunters and the general public on lead ammunition, available alternatives, and strategy used in other locations. The Oregon State University Research Center, which has extensive experience conducting public opinion surveys, was contracted to conduct a survey and to collect the data for ODFW and the OSU Wildlife Extension Unit. The information gathered from the survey effort will be critical in future discussions regarding condors and any related discussions regarding lead ammunition. As the state's wildlife management agency, the department felt it should take the lead on assessing hunter opinions, rather than having to respond to surveys conducted by other organizations that may not accurately reflect the views of hunters and the public. A scientific survey conducted by a respected professional organization should minimize bias and ensure that the views of hunters and the public are represented as fairly as possible. Preliminary results of this survey are expected early in 2015. The survey effort is not, as some allege, the first step towards a ban on lead ammunition. There are no proposals or plans by the department or commission to ban or restrict the use of lead ammunition. The use of lead ammunition for hunting is legal in Oregon, with the general exception of waterfowl hunting. The department sees no reason to change that. A well-designed voluntary program should be sufficient to meet Fish and Wildlife Service requirements to address lead exposure should condors appear in Oregon. The survey results will be useful in developing that program should it become necessary. In closing, the department is gathering hunter and public input so that we are prepared for the eventual reappearance of condors in Oregon. Doing anything less would be a disservice to hunters, the public, and Oregon's fish and wildlife resources. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator for the Department.
You also have a copy of our PowerPoint presentation, so I won't hit on every one of the slides simply to help with timing, but I will focus in on a few of them that I think would be really helpful to you. As Roy has said, the condors are the focus of why we're doing this survey. When you look at the historic range of condors here in Oregon, they obviously covered a good portion of the state. They were first documented by a European man, by Lewis and Clark. The last known condor in the state was actually killed in southwest Oregon in the mid-30s. Currently, condors are found in several release sites down in California. And the California areas are under full ESA protection, and the release sites over in Arizona were part of an experimental non-essential population, which actually allows more flexibility for Arizona Game and Fish in how they manage programs and allowed them to really pursue their voluntary lead program that we'll talk about here in a second. Roy's already hit on the threats that have been identified to condors by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They're the ones that are driving this on the recovery efforts, so I won't go into that much more. You're all aware of the California ban. That was not something that was proposed by the California Commission, but it was something that their legislature decided to take up. And is something that obviously all the states around California were watching with a great deal of interest because of the condor concerns and reintroduction of the birds and how that might impact other states. Arizona, as I said, was allowed to implement a voluntary program. They've been very successful with that. One of the things that they have done was they pulled together a stakeholder group to really talk about the program. They did hunter surveys and general public surveys, and that's some of the recommendations they actually have made to other states that have been told that they will likely have condors in the near future is don't wait until the birds show up. Get out ahead of it and start working on what you might need to deal with and finding out what your constituents really think. Utah just recently ended up with condors in their state coming from Arizona, and Utah now, under the federal ESA, also has had to deal with the lead issue in their hunting seasons in the southwest portion of the state, and they've been following Arizona's example with a voluntary exchange program. This kind of gives you an example of bird movement from the release sites there in the Grand Canyon in Arizona. The birds moving into Colorado and up to Montana or Wyoming and back is a movement of about 250 miles altogether. It's not unusual for a bird to move 150 miles in one day and move back. Here's an example of one GPS-collared bird down in California in the Central Valley and showing its movements over about a three-week period of time, ranging from nearly down in the Grapevine and the Tejon Ranch up on top of the Grapevine just south of Bakersfield, all the way to the north up to San Jose. So what does that mean for us? As Roy mentioned, the service has entered into agreements with the Yurok tribe. We expect that there will be releases within 2 to 5 years on the reservation in Northern California. And the graph on the left, or the picture on the left, kind of shows where the Yurok reservation is. The picture on the right, each one of those arrows represents 100 miles. So based on what we know about the birds, based on the movement of the birds, it kind of gives you a feel for what we would expect once birds start moving, where we would expect them to show up. And the service would then be looking at ESA take from lead in Oregon. Again, Arizona and Utah both have told us, get out ahead of it, don't wait. And anything you can do as soon as possible to understand what your constituents think is well worth it. And that's what led us, as Roy said, into the survey effort and wanting to know what our primary constituents think. And we felt very strongly that we needed to know that. And then finally, we'll have the results late this fall, early winter, and make all those available to the public, to the legislature. You know, the lead issue itself, I've been talking with sport group leaders, conservation group leaders, and boards of some of the statewide groups now for about 3 years about condors and lead, and warning them that things are happening and that we can likely see it happening and coming into the state. And the service has moved even closer to making that happen. So that concludes our presentation.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, certainly appreciate your appearance. Can you give us just kind of the 30,000-foot look-see of what a voluntary plan might entail?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What the program that's held up as the example is what's happened in Arizona. And in Arizona, they have partnered up with various industry organizations, sporting goods stores, and the hunting community. They've received special allocations of funding from their legislature, and they conduct an ammo exchange. And so they'll give a person a coupon that you can take that coupon in and turn in a box of lead ammunition and get a free box of lead alternative, copper ammunition. And in addition to that, they know that there's people that don't want to make that change, so they have a gut pile retrieval, in pretty gross terms, program that they've implemented, that if you bring your gut pile and the offal out of the woods and bring that into a check station, then they enter you into a drawing for items that have been donated by various organizations. So it can be from ATVs to guns to camping equipment, things like that. And Arizona has had between 80% and 90% compliance under their voluntary program. That has been challenged by some of the non-governmental organizations out there. That was, they were taken to court over that, and the court and service was taken to court over it, and the court upheld the voluntary program as appropriate and as a way to address the threat.
Thank you very much. Representative Krieger, and then committee members, we're going to probably have to move on. I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either one of you know anything about the migration time of year, like our vultures in Oregon leave sometime November, December, come back in February, March. Do these birds have summer type pattern, do you know?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, we don't know 100% for sure what will happen here in Oregon. There's some speculation that Oregon may have been a summer area historically, and that in the wintertime it was wet enough and damp enough. Condors really need thermals to be able to move, and that in the wintertime that they may have gone south. They certainly, in the Arizona-Utah area, have seen similar type movements, that birds will move out of the Grand Canyon up into Utah during the summertime. And they first started being noticed around sheep allotments on federal forest land in southwestern Utah. And then as hunting seasons and everything kind of come to a conclusion and the grazing allotments are closed down for the winter, the birds tend to move back into the canyon in Arizona.
Okay, thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. And Roy, the federal government's getting a great meeting. I'd like to call up next, please, Dan Edge and Colin Eagle Smith, please. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Edge. I'm the department head in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Oregon State University. I'm just going to take a couple of minutes to sort of set the stage, and then I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Colin Eagle Smith, who really is the expert We were asked to provide some information regarding the impact of lead on condors and other wildlife, and pardon me, and that's what Colin will do. But knowing that this is probably an issue that will come again before this body, I did want to at least apprise you of what the expertise is at Oregon State University relative to this type of information. And so very quickly, we have several people that have at least some expertise or some interest in the issue. Dr. Dana Sanchez is an Extension Wildlife Specialist that ODF&W mentioned, who worked with them to design the survey and to implement the survey through the Survey Research Center. Dr. Sanchez actually is a mammal habitat ecologist, but she has a special interest in what we call human dimensions of fish and wildlife management, which is sort of the sociology, hence the survey. As a former Fish and Wildlife Commissioner, I'd say I'm very proud of ODF&W engaging with Dr. Sanchez on this. This information from this survey will be critical in informing policy and management decisions. So I'm delighted to see them get ahead of the situation. We have another professor, Dr. Clinton Epps, who's an associate professor of wildlife ecology, mostly as a geneticist, but he is a longtime rifle competitor, and is interested in ballistics research. I believe I passed the committee a paper that he wrote recently entitled, Considering the Switch, Challenges of Transitioning to Non-Lead Hunting Ammunition, in which he lines out what some of the many challenges are going to be if hunters decide that they want to switch. It's not a simple proposition, as we've already heard. Dr. Susan Haig is a courtesy professor of wildlife and a USGS senior scientist. She basically is a small population demographer and has worked on condor recovery, specifically related to population genetics. She and a graduate student just recently published a book on condors in the Pacific Northwest, which has all the historical information about where we think they occurred. Other expertise at Oregon State University, of course, there's the entire Department of Molecular and Environmental Toxicology. So if this committee becomes interested in environmental fates, risk assessment, or human health concerns, I would recommend you contact Dr. Craig Marcus, who is the department head. And so now I'm going to yield my time to Dr. Colin Eaglesmith. He's a courtesy assistant professor in our department and is a supervisory research ecologist with USGS. He is an expert in toxicology and wildlife health type issues. In particular, he's interested in the interactions of ecological processes and contaminant bioaccumulation and effects on wild populations. He is also a co-author with Dr. Susan Haig of another chapter in the book that I just referenced, and I believe the committee has that copy. And with those introductory remarks, I'll yield my time to Dr. Eaglesmith.
Okay. Thank you very much, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Colin Eaglesmith with the U.S. Geological Survey. My lab focuses largely research on the bioaccumulation and exposure of environmental contaminants in wildlife and fish and the ecotoxicological effects of those contaminants on avian and fish communities. I'm going to use my time today to talk briefly about the background of lead as an environmental contaminant and what we know about exposure in wildlife communities and the potential impacts to those wildlife species. I'm not going to touch too much on the actual effects of California condors. Dr. Finkelstein is here, and she's an expert on that, so I'm going to yield that discussion to her. So lead is a naturally occurring element in geological material. Its distribution and occurrence in the environment has been increased dramatically over the last several hundred years due to human activities. And it's a neurotoxin known to impair reproduction. It can also impact behavior and various physiological processes. The toxicological effects of lead have been linked to a number of human-derived sources, including consumption or exposure to legacy lead paint chips in wildlife, as well as mining and smelting processes, lead sinkers and fishing tackle, and ammunition. Those are all sources of lead that have been documented associated with various effects in different fish and wildlife species. We're here today because the concern about lead in hunting ammunition is acute, largely because when lead is released in the environment as ammunition, it's released into habitats where wildlife co-occur, and fragments that are left behind in gut piles are essentially left behind in a food resource for scavengers and other wildlife species. Modern lead-cored bullets are designed to expand upon impact. They distribute their fragments through the wound channel, and so you don't have one large slug in an organism. You have a number of very small fragments that are distributed along the course of the wound channel. This results in two things. First, the small fragments have a larger surface area than one large slug, so that can increase the assimilation and absorption of lead into the digestive tract. Secondarily, in scavengers and other social foraging species, you can have more than one individual exposed when you have the lead distributed through a carcass. So things like vultures or condors that forage socially, you can have multiple individuals exposed to lead when they're foraging on a carcass that does have lead fragments in them. The stomach acids dissolve the lead, and it can then assimilate into the circulatory system where it elicits a range of physiological effects. Two of the most prevalent and common effects that we see in wildlife are the inhibition of blood protein heme synthesis, so it's the precursor to hemoglobin, it can result in anemia, and then a very deleterious effect we see is neurological impacts in various wildlife species, and this is largely due to the fact that lead mimics calcium in vertebrate bodies, and calcium is an important component of nerve signaling, and so it can actually block the movement of nerve signals through an organism, resulting in altered foraging behavior, in lethargy, and poor coordination, ultimately poor survival. One of the complications in understanding lead risk in wildlife is that there's limited actual, despite the fact we've been researching this for decades, there is very limited information on strong toxicological benchmarks across a range of species. There's very good knowledge on a few species that have been very, very well studied, not very clear understanding of the baseline effects and concentrations that elicit effects in wildlife across a range of species at lower concentrations. There's also a lot of variation in the sensitivity of different species to exposure to lead. So a recent scientific survey of scientific publications, over 80 publications were surveyed in this review, found that when looking at a lead, highest concentration that would cause no observable effects across a range of different species, there was a 1,600-fold range in that concentration that caused no effects across species. When you look at the concentrations in blood, there's a less of a range, about 50-fold range in that lowest effects concentration, but still tremendous variation in different species and their sensitivities to lead. So you can't use a benchmark developed for a quail and apply it to a lead concentration that you might measure in the blood of a golden eagle or a condor. And there's limited information what the toxicological thresholds are of those other species. Now, moving on to wildlife exposure to lead ammunition, I'm going to stick to an example of big game largely. There are a number of vectors associated with lead-based ammunition. But when there have been studies on deer shot with a single bullet and hundreds of fragments have been left behind in the carcass, and on average about 160 small fragments are left in the gut piles. The species obviously most likely to be exposed to those fragments are scavenging species such as turkey vultures, condors, ravens, and raptors such as eagles and hawks. For those species to be exposed, you need to have overlap in both space and time. So understanding the life history strategy of the species, condors, or any other species, and the spatial and temporal distribution of hunting activities and the distribution of lead in the environment is very important.
Dr. Eagle Smith,
yes, sir.
I apologize, sir, but can you wrap this up? Could you
yes.
hit the high points?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Recent work in Wyoming has found that during the hunting season, about 47% of ravens were exposed to elevated levels of lead in their blood. Outside the hunting season, 2% of ravens were exposed to lead. Similarly, in California, during the hunting season, vultures were twice as likely to be exposed to lead, and the lead concentrations in their blood were about twice as high as during the non-hunting season. So finally, moving into what we know about lead in Oregon and lead in the wildlife in Oregon, that's a tremendous data gap. There's very little information about exposure rates in free-flying wild birds. There's a lot of information from rehabilitation communities, and the information they provide is great for birds that are sick or injured. However, we know very little about free-flying or free-ranging wildlife species in the state. We're currently doing research at USGS looking at scavengers across the state. We have collected blood samples from about 465 birds over the last 2 to 3 years, and we expect those preliminary results to be out in the next 6 to 12 months, at which point that will really help facilitate an understanding of potential hotspots of exposure for condors or other wildlife species in the state. With that, I thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Gentlemen, appreciate your testimony. Committee members, I just don't have time to open it up to general questions, but if someone has that burning question that you feel needs to be asked to clarify anything, I would accept a question.
I do have a question.
Representative Whitson, please.
I was wondering what caused the initial decline in the condor in the 1970s. I understood it was thinning shells from pesticides. Is that correct?
The thinning shells from pesticides was one factor in the decline, yes. There's the thought that lead was a contributing factor, as well as actual shooting of the condors for feathers and other things, and exposure to DDT and other pesticides resulted in thin egg shells and inability of them to reproduce.
That's what I was told, but I would assume that we've now had a recovery.
There is some evidence that some birds foraging along the coastlines are still receiving elevated levels of DDT, or actually it's breakdown product, DDE, and there have been at least a few eggshells that have been recovered recently that have been thinned. So these are birds along the Southern California Bight, where there still is elevated concentrations of DDE in the sediments.
So we really don't know what's causing, we can't say there is a single source that's causing the condors to decline, given that they're back on the upswing after the 1970s. So I just want to establish that we don't know that lead is causing the decline of the condors or is actually a problem.
Yeah, I think Dr. Finkelstein can speak to that for sure.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your appearance. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Professor Finkelstein and Deborah Schaefer, please.
I think Jehovah's meeting on Friday instead of letting the public that we're not allowed to say anything. Can you answer that?
Sir, I'm going to have to ask you, please, respect the process. We have a lot of people to testify. Welcome to our committee. Thank you for your appearance. Please introduce yourselves and proceed.
Right. Hello, Chair Witt and the members of the committee. Thank you. I'm honored to be here today. My name is Dr. Finkelstein, and I've been studying the effects of environmental impacts from lead poisoning on wildlife species, including California condors, over the last 10 years. I would like to say that I've published work that demonstrates that lead poisoning from spent lead ammunition is the number one or principal cause of mortality for California condors in California, and we've showed that the mortality related directly to lead poisoning from ingesting spent lead ammunition is preventing the recovery of the California condor in California. So that's been published. I'd be happy to pass that out to anyone. I also just wanted to briefly address one other point that was raised, and that was that although the volunteer programs in Arizona have been incredibly successful in terms of participation rates of 90%, we have yet to see that translate to an impact or to a significant reduction and the number of dead condors from lead poisoning. So there seems to be a lot of people participating, but we have not seen that translated into fewer dead lead poison condors. Some of the work that we've also published has illustrated that very low carcass contamination rates across the landscape can actually still result in a high probability that an individual scavenger or California condor is lead poisoned. And some of that work is actually in your package. So moving on to my more general testimony, as Dr. Eaglesmith testified, lead is one of the most well-studied toxins, and there's a vast amount of scientific evidence that shows that lead is toxic to multiple physiological systems across multiple vertebrate species. For children, children are particularly susceptible to lead poisoning, and there's currently no level of lead exposure known to be without long-term cognitive impairment for children, none. To help inform the public about the effects of spent lead ammunition on human and wildlife health in March of 2013, I joined with 29 other scientists, the world's leading experts, including physicians, veterinarians, toxicologists, and wildlife biologists in the field of lead and environmental health to release a consensus statement of scientists, which is also in your packet. As a co-author of this consensus statement, I can affirm that this was an unbiased assessment of the best scientific evidence that states lead is a powerful toxicant, harmful to human health and the environment, and that the discharge from lead ammunition from activities such as hunting potentially exposes wildlife and humans to detrimental amounts of lead. Lead-based ammunition production is the second largest annual use of lead in the United States, and consequently, lead-based ammunition is likely the greatest, largely unregulated source of lead knowingly discharged into the environment in the United States. In contrast, other significant sources of lead in the environment, such as leaded paint and leaded gasoline, are recognized as harmful and have been significantly reduced or eliminated over the last 50 years. Lead bullets used to shoot wildlife, as Dr. Eaglesmith attested, can fragment to hundreds of small pieces, with large proportions being sufficiently small to be easily ingested by scavenging animals or incorporated into processed meat for human consumption. And published studies have documented this occurrence. Lead poisoning from the ingestion of spent lead ammunition fragments poses a particularly serious threat for scavenging species, including California condors, but also golden eagles, bald eagles, ravens, and turkey vultures. And published studies have documented that Oregon wildlife is also affected by lead poisoning, most probably from lead poisoning from ingesting spent lead ammunition from hunting. Our published work illustrates that even a small number, this is what I said earlier, of lead-containing carcasses across the landscape can lead to a high probability that a scavenging species is lead-exposed. And given the vast body of scientific evidence demonstrating that the use of lead in ammunition is a serious threat to human and wildlife health, the conclusion of our consensus statement of scientists, again made up of 30 of the world's leading experts on lead and environmental and human health, was that given the availability of non-lead alternative products for hunting, reducing and eventually eliminating the introduction of lead into the environment from lead-based ammunition is a reasonable and equitable action to protect human and wildlife health. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Dr. Schaefer.
Good afternoon, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Deborah Schaefer. I'm a wildlife veterinarian with over 20 years of experience treating injured wildlife, serving as the wildlife veterinarian at the Audubon Society of Portland's Wildlife Care Center for the past 10 years. We treat approximately 3,000 injured wild animals per year. Today, I'm here representing the Audubon Society of Portland and our 15,000 members. I'm here to convey a very simple message. Lead is poison. We have banned lead from gasoline, paint, and other uses because of its toxic effects. It is banned from use in waterfowl hunting because of well-documented impacts on ducks, geese, and swans. However, we continue to allow lead to be used in other forms of hunting. We knowingly and intentionally shoot huge quantities of lead into the environment, and once in the environment, it can enter the food chain through either direct ingestion or through scavenging of gut piles or carcasses left in the environment. And please make no mistake, this does happen. Each year, wildlife hospitals across Oregon and across the United States devote huge resources to treat bald and golden eagles and other species that have been impacted by this unnecessary and avoidable threat. Lead poisoning can happen rapidly or can accumulate in an animal system over time. It takes a very small amount of lead, as mentioned previously today, just a fragment to cause potentially lethal impacts. Lead poisoning affects essentially all organ systems. Symptoms can include weakness, disorientation, emaciation, anemia, seizures, blindness, among other signs. I have to say lead poison cases are some of the saddest cases we see in our hospital. They are truly suffering animals. By the time they reach us, most of them cannot be saved. And for those that do survive, the recovery can take months and cost thousands of dollars. One example is an adult bald eagle that came into our center from Longview last year and was treated at our facility. It took 4 weeks of intense therapy and then 3 months more of rehabilitation so it could gain strength and conditioning to be suitable for release back to the wild. Some will tell you that the unnecessary and wasteful death of a wild animal from lead poisoning is not a matter for concern. They're wrong. First of all, we know that what we're seeing in wildlife hospitals across the United States is just the tip of the iceberg. Most wild animals that suffer lead poisoning are never recovered. These deaths, for the most part, occur in remote places, and the natural instinct of a wild animal when it is sick is to hide. The fact that wildlife hospitals see as many poisoned animals as they do is indicative of a far larger problem. Second, the wasteful and completely unnecessary deaths of our native wildlife should not be something we accept. Most of these species are protected at the federal and state level. Some of them, such as the bald eagle, we've spent decades and millions of dollars recovering. Just as we work to reduce poaching, electrocutions, other forms of poisoning, and to restore habitat, we should also be working diligently to reduce the toxic impacts of lead on these species. Finally, I don't believe that if anyone in this room actually saw a bald eagle suffering the effects of lead poisoning, they could stand here and say that it does not matter. Lead poisoning is a horrendous, sad way to die. The impacts of lead ammunition on wildlife are well documented. There are alternatives to lead. Just as we have done with gasoline, paint, and numerous other sources of environmental lead, it's time to get the lead out of our ammunition used for hunting. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, limited questions for Drs. Finkelstein and Schaefer. What was the method of exposure? Was it ingestion of the lead? How was that exposure? How did that occur? You mentioned the bald eagle.
Yes, it was ingestion, and actually in that bald eagle, we were actually the first day it came in able to see radiographic evidence of metal in its stomach, but it was by ingestion.
All right. Anything else? Thank you both very, very much. Appreciate your appearance. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Stan Steele, Kevin Starrett, and Dan Reed. And gentlemen, to the extent that you can be brief and to the point, it would be greatly appreciated. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you for making yourselves available. Please decide among yourselves who goes first.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dan Reed, a state liaison with the National Rifle Association. I want to thank you for having us here and allowing us to be part of this informational hearing on this lead survey. I know personally a lot of our Oregon members have reached out to me with concerns with the number of editorials that have been run in the papers in this campaign along with the survey that came out with by ODFW and OSU. Just wanted to point something out. I'm encouraging the members, if this does come before the committee, to really look at the science and look at it hard and the underlying data. One of the messages we heard today was lead is bad. We heard that. And I didn't hear anyone point out the difference in elemental lead and industrial lead. And we heard about legacy paint and gasoline, and we heard about bullets, and they all got lumped into one category. But they're very different. Lead ammunition is an elemental lead, which is much different, has much different characteristics, and there's much different exposure compared to the industrial lead. So I really encourage you to look at that, look at these studies, see how the science was being performed, what's the underlying basis for it. Now, the reason that you called the hearing today is for this survey, and I was here to get a lot of information and soak in what's the plan, and Mr. Elliker did a great job of explaining it, and we want to thank him for his service. He's leaving right now. Thank you very much, and best of luck on your next endeavors. So that was very enlightening. One of the things that was of concern with this survey, and I'm trying to keep it very brief,
thank you,
was when you looked at this, there was one question in particular where It asks the hunters surveyed, what would influence you to switch your to non-lead ammunition? Seemed like kind of a leading question, and I was kind of curious where they were going with that. And I couldn't help but notice when I was scouring the internet that the Oregon Zoo is advertising for a wildlife and lead outreach coordinator. It's a well-paying job, $55,000 to $73,000 a year. And if you look at the summary here, for the Oregon Zoo's Conservation and Research Division, is looking for a wildlife and lead outreach coordinator to spearhead the development and implementation of a wildlife and lead outreach initiative. The program is envisioned to provide education and outreach with the goal of reducing the exposure of wildlife and lead, which has been identified as a significant cause of morbidity, mortality, in wildlife. And then it talks about the coordinator will travel throughout the state to build relationships with hunters. I just thought it was interesting how these two documents came out at a very similar time. I didn't know what the purpose of the survey was. I just wanted to make sure this was brought to everyone's attention that this is going on, and there could be some advocacy with your tax dollars as far as furthering this agenda. The California model was mentioned in 2007. We had an outright ban in the Condor region, despite 99.8% compliance, or roughly about there. The lead levels in the condors remained stagnant. In some cases, we saw an increase. And so it wasn't effective, but California chose to go to a statewide ban that's being implemented over the next few years. I would encourage you to look at that hard, and let's make sure we're basing everything on fact. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
For the record, my name is Kevin Sterrett. I'm with the Oregon Firearms Federation. Thank you for the invitation to speak to you today. I prefer to testify when I have a bill to deal with, and quite frankly, I'm quite certain we will be facing a bill or perhaps an administrative rule. But based on some previous testimony, I think that clearly in some people's ultimate goal is a complete ban on the availability of lead ammunition, period. I looked at the survey. I didn't receive one, obviously, but I did look at it. It didn't seem it was fair or unbiased to me at all. As Mr. Reed pointed out, it definitely seemed to be some leading questions with an effort to get a specific response. The fact is, as Mr. Reed said, there is a lot of competing science on this. And as he pointed out, in California, the ban not only failed to work, but resulted in elevated levels of lead in some condors. A previous speaker testified that in the state where there was a voluntary program with massive compliance, that it didn't work. So it's hard to conclude that when lead is being removed and the problem's not being solved, that lead is actually the problem. The other thing I want to point out is that there are not really very many good alternatives to lead for bullets. The fact is that bullets are made of lead for a reason, because of the density, because of the ability to this is the composition of lead is ideal, and it's going to be very, very difficult and very, very expensive to replace that. There's one of the few alternatives is something like depleted uranium, which I don't think anybody really wants to use. But to replace lead in bullets is, for the most part, really not practical at all. And so, given the extreme difficulty of creating an alternative and the cost, and at this point, no real evidence that it's had any positive effect, I think we should pay a lot of attention to this as the inevitable bill or administrative rule comes rolling down the pike.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escoval, members of the committee, my name is Stan Steele, representing the Oregon Outdoor Council, and just hunters and shooters. This is going to be a contentious issue. It's not going to be solved today. I would say that probably not going to be solved in the next year or two. It took a long path in California, and actually tomorrow California will be having hearing on how to implement their AB 711, their lead ban, which is going to be phased in over a period of years. Actually, I think it has to be phased in totally by 2019. Still controversial whether that legislation actually is going to work in California and actually help the condor. I think both speakers and what we've heard before really outlines the depth and breadth of the issue. Hunting is huge to Oregon. Shooting is huge to Oregon. Hunting and shooting nationally provides the bulk of the Pittman Robinson funding. Our agencies and our wildlife depend on adequate funding, because certainly other sources have not stepped to the forefront. So as we move through this debate, let's keep caution, move slowly, understand that there is a lot of science on both sides of this, And just because you're a scientist doesn't mean that you do not have a scientific bias on issues. I think most of us out here in this community understand that. Agenda-driven science would be the worst policy science to use. Let's keep it fair, respectable to all user groups, but understand ultimately all of us want the same thing, what's best for Oregon, best for our wildlife, and I think decisions then will be properly be made. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee members, once again, I recognize that there may be some very pressing questions here. We're a little bit over time, but if someone has the question that needs to be answered and we have our experts, I want to allow that. I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, I do have I have one of those questions. Are any of you, possibly all of you, familiar with the terminal ballistics of a lead bullet, a jacketed lead bullet? Any of you familiar with that? Because I have a question for anyone who is.
I would probably defer. I'm going to be relatively confident, but I'd be concerned about the question.
All right. Let me pose the question and see if any of you feel competent to be able to answer it. It has the appearance, at least to me, that there is an assumption that jacketed lead bullets fragment upon impact with an animal. Now, I am a hunter myself. I personally do not choose to hunt with fragmentary bullets. They are not terribly effective, at least that's been my experience. And none of the hunters that I'm aware of choose that type of ammunition either. That hunters typically look for a bullet that, upon impact, mushrooms and holes together for penetration purposes. Is the assumption that lead bullets fragment, is there an assumption here that the bullet is just lead and we are not considering the jacketing effect of a bullet? Would you comment on this, please?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel, and members of the committee, I think I can address that. 25 years, I checked literally thousands of Oregon deer and elk. I was a former Fish and Wildlife officer. I examined many necropsies, field necropsies, as those old game guys talked about, trying to find the bullet, trying to find fragments, because oftentimes they were very, very important evidence in prosecution, especially if we had a crime, poaching of whatever it may be. I think Michigan or Minnesota just completed a research study where they used 250 carcasses, sheep or pig, can't remember which exactly, where they shot bullets into these carcasses. We did hear that bullets just fragment, and that they could be, because of that fragmentation, could be very susceptible to all type of scavengers or anything, coyotes or whatever else might want to eat on them. That's not really true. In some cases, it's very true. But to generalize, and Chair Witt, you're absolutely correct. The last thing we want to do on a piece of hunting ammunition is to have it fragment, not leave a wound channel that actually does a massive amount of damage. That's the kill power. That's the downrange impact. I've actually used Barnes All Copper. They're a good bullet. But for earlier testimony, you indicated this alternative ammunition is widespread and available. Untrue. Twice the cost. Availability is extremely limited. Mail order in many cases impossible. So I think what we have to make sure is that the information is clear, precise, and accurate, and ballistics are going to be a big portion of that discussion.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I have the good fortune to have some associates and friends who are very well-versed in this, and I did go to them and ask them questions like that. And one of the things they pointed out is, and I have the notes they gave me, the objective is to design a bullet that is dense enough to penetrate, strong enough to hold together to break bones, but malleable enough to expand to create a large wound channel while dumping all of the bullet's energy inside the animal, which would not be what how you would describe a fragmentary bullet.
Vice Chair Esquivel, did you have a question?
Yeah, well, actually, I can chime in a little bit here. I took an elk one time and hit him three times in his tenderloins, and all three bullets stayed inside. And I weighed those bullets, and there wasn't a grain difference in all three weights from what I started with and from what I finished with. So no offense, but I just don't subscribe to what some people are saying in this hearing.
I have a final question. I don't know if any of the other committee members, but my last question, hopefully we can move on. Again, my personal experience, I'm not suggestive that this is necessarily true across the board, but it's counterintuitive to think that jacketed bullets are stopped by, excuse the graphic nature, but intestines and guts, if you will, that it's usually hard bone matter and other parts of the animal. Oftentimes, the opposite side cape or skin is what actually ends up stopping that projectile. Do we have reason to believe that it's common for guts to stop projectiles?
No, I don't think so, Mr. Chairman. As a matter of fact, as you're probably aware, there are rounds of ammunition that are specifically designed to fragment. They're used in defense, and they're completely different from what would be used to hunt. And if bullets fragmented by their nature, there'd be no reason to specially design a bullet that did that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Krieger.
In Oregon, we're taught to properly try to take an animal, which means you don't shoot it in the guts. Maybe in California they do.
Representative Whitsitt.
I just have a comment. It's not quite related to this, but it is in a way. We have thousands of raptors dying yearly by flying into wind power generating facilities across the West, and yet our government gives these industries a pass even on endangered species. So I have a really hard time saying, you know, on one hand, we forgive it, and on the other hand, we don't. So.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your appearance. Thank you. And with that, we're going to move on to ODF and W fee proposals. I'd like to call forward once again, please, Roy Elliker and Debbie Colbert.
Thank God I won't go.
Or Colbert.
No one mentioned that was a patient.
Yeah, I know.
Was this the gal that
No. I don't think so.
She's from Oregon State.
Oh well, I don't know. I don't so think so.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Director, you know how to clear a room.
Mr. Chair, for the record, should I wait a second or should I go?
Yeah, maybe just a second. And just to help you and to help me, if we can do the two of you in 15 minutes would be great.
Mr. Chair, I think we can do that.
Thank you.
Sure. Mr. Chair, once again, for the record, Roy Elliker, Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and on my right, Ms. Debbie Colbert, our Deputy for Administration, also with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We do have a short PowerPoint here to go through what's been requested by this committee as our 2015 hunting and fishing license fee proposals, and we can get started on that right away. And
Thank
Ms. Colbert's going to start, and I'm going to finish.
Thank you.
I know the committee was interested in talking about our 2015 fee proposals, but just to give a little bit of context to the work we've been doing on those fee proposals, this is our agency request budget for 2015-17. As you can see, it's quite the mix of federal funds, other funds, general fund, and lottery as we've proposed. But as a kind of context for the discussion of our recreational fees, you can also see that even though it's a mix of funding, those funds that flow from hunters and anglers is actually pretty large. Of the federal funds we receive, almost a third of those federal funds are because of the pass-through from the federal government of excise taxes on sporting gear and ammunition and other items. And then in our other funds, it's about $100 million out of the $150 million of other funds we receive is directly the sale of recreational licenses and tags. So it's a pretty important piece as we build our budget for your consideration is our fee proposals. And again, just to set some context for what we will be discussing in 2015, our last fee proposal was approved by the 2009 legislature, and it adjusted our recreational, our occupational, and our commercial licenses and tags, and it was effective in January 2010. At that time, we made a commitment to our stakeholders and to the legislature that we would make those revenues last 6 years. And that has been our typical cycle, where we do six-year increments on our fee adjustments. So 2013-15, the budget that we're in right now, is essentially the end of that six-year period, and we are tracking to meet our commitment to make it the 6 years as we had promised to our stakeholders and our customers. As we look forward into the next six-year horizon, we are looking at having less carryover or less reserves or savings moving into the next six-year period for a number of reasons. Over the 6 years that we've been operating under our 2010 fee schedule, we've really seen lower than originally projected revenues, especially in the area of non-residents. It's about 6% lower in terms of participation in revenue for non-residents than what we had predicted in 2009 when we brought the proposal to the legislature. We also, over the course of the 6 years, there have been fund shifts where, for example, general fund would be taken out of the budget and instead we would be using license dollars. So again, that shortened some of our reserves moving into this next six-year period. This last biennium in 13-15, we've had higher than what we had originally projected in terms of some personnel costs. And then it would be no surprise to you that we've also had a lot less interest earning on carryover funds over the course of these 6 years because of the economy. We have been working on a combination of strategies to plan our entire budget request. And it really relies on a number of strategies, including proposed adjustments to our recreational and commercial licenses and tags. And that's what we were going to talk to you about today. We've been working essentially for about 8 months with our stakeholders. We have a pretty extensive public process for building our budget as a state agency. Even more so this go-round, given the fact that we were really looking at some significant changes in terms of how we were funded and proposing changes to fees. We have a large budget advisory committee. You'll be hearing from three members of that budget advisory committee on your panel today. Numerous meetings with them to design our fee proposal, gather their input. We also host a series of town hall meetings across the state. To gather broader public input on what we're proposing. We've received numerous comments to our commission on the budget proposal. And then we also did, this was new to us this go-round, we sent out quite a few surveys to hunters and anglers, non-resident and resident, to try to get even more input from our customers in terms of how we would design any fee adjustments, new concepts that they wanted us to look at, and ways that we could just be more customer-friendly in terms of how we package hunting and angling licenses.
So we're going to share with you, members of the committee, our fee adjustment restructuring proposal here in just a second. We've tried very hard to incorporate all the public input that Deputy Director Colbert has talked about. We tried to look at strategic adjustments across the board rather than just across the board increases. We look based on our survey results. In particular, we're looking at a schedule of two-year incremental by a smaller amount rather than just a flat-out fee increase and then maintain for 6 years. We're going to look to promote participation even more by youth and families, and I'm going to show you how we're going to do that, and some new license concepts. So new license concepts I wanted to cover for this committee because I think there'll be a lot of discussion about some of them. So some of you may know that last session the legislature passed a bill that allowed us to move to selling hunting and fishing licenses on not just an annual basis, but also a three-year basis or a five-year basis. So we're going to have roll that out this year for 2016. I'm sorry, for 2016 after this legislative session. And it's going to sell, we're going to have license availability in 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year increments. By having people buy 3 and 5 year licenses, that really helps what they call the churn. In other words, probably about as many as 30 to 40% of all license buyers don't buy licenses every single year. They tend to buy when they want to go hunting and fishing, but that may not be every 12 months. So when you have someone step up and buy a three-year license or a five-year license, you're not working very hard to get them to make sure they buy a license next year. They're already signed up. It's a sweet deal in some ways for us. And in some states that have already moved to this multi-year concept, they can already see a change and see the impact that's making to the positive for revenues. The Pioneer license, you're going to have a lot of discussion about this, because right now, residents of Oregon that are, I believe, over 65 and have lived here 50 years get a free hunting and fishing license, and that's been in effect for many decades. However, because of the way the federal government distributes the excise tax revenue Debbie talked about from the sale of hunting and fishing ammunition, marine gasoline, boats, other hunting and fishing accessories, when we give that free license, it kind of disqualifies us with that license to get the federal revenue we could normally get by charging something for it. So by charging very minimal fees, maybe $6, we're going to turn around and gain the equivalent of another $14 of federal money through the excise tax program. It's a little complicated, but when we ran it through our survey, with the exception of the folks already holding Pioneer licenses, most folks who are looking forward to Pioneer licenses said they'd be willing to pay a small fee, particularly if it kept the overall price of hunting and fishing licenses low. But I'm sure we'll have a lot of discussion about that in this next session. We're going to be looking for some unique fishing opportunity raffles. We're going to look for a premier hunt series for deer and elk, and I'll move right through these, Mr. Chair, I know in the interest of time. And we're thinking of just of adding an additional fee for folks fishing in the ocean. And that comes about because some of our ocean fisheries, whether it's tuna, whether it's halibut, whether it's bottom fish, more and more increasingly we have more work to do to ensure we can have those fisheries. NOAA Fisheries in particular wants more and more information and data about harvest and about catch and how we manage those fisheries. That comes at a cost to us to do all that work and collect that data. And so right now, those ocean fisheries are being supported by general license fees from everybody that goes fishing. What we were thinking is for folks that do that kind of ocean fishing, maybe have them pay a little bit more of a fee up front to help support those specific expenses that come with keeping those fisheries open and robust. I'm very proud of this concept because we're going to make it even simpler for families with young kids to go hunting and fishing and shell fishing in Oregon, because here's the deal. $10. If you have any children or grandchildren between 10 and 17, for $10, you're going to buy one license for them. They're going to be able to hunt. They're going to be able to fish. They're going to go crabbing, go razor clamming. That's it. One-time fee, $10 each year. It's going to apply to resident kids and non-resident kids. Columbia endorsement and ocean endorsement would be included. No additional fee there. There'll be, because of some of the federal requirements on waterfowl and upland birds, something called a HIP, which some of you know very well what it is, which is that harvest information program. we're trying hard to have no cost for waterfowl and upland birds, but it got so confusing we had to go with a reduced cost on that. But the bottom line is there'll be no increase on the juvenile sports pack, which provides all kinds of tags and opportunities for a total of $55, and it's very popular among young families to hunt and fish a lot. And then on top of that, we're just going to make it very simple for the $10 fee for whatever. If your kids want to go hunting and fishing, $10, you're there. Here's an example of some of the adjustments we're proposing. Again, these will be coming to this committee for some discussion, I am sure, as well as Ways and Means, which will lead to discussion. You can see overall, like in a hunting license, it's a $5 increase over about, or yeah, even a little less than that, but about a $5 increase through 2020. Not very much of an increase, frankly, about the price of a pint of beer, and if you're Portland, maybe a little less than a pint of beer. Control Hunt apps, for those who use the big game hunters, know that those are the applications that people file to apply to go big game hunting in the state. One of the lessons we learned back in 2009 is that when we substantially raised the cost of these applications, is that hunters pretty much let us know that was the worst thing we could have done. That was their number one complaint about the fee package in 2009, is that we raised the application fee for them to apply for different big game hunts. So we learned something from that, and in this proposal, you'll see there's no change. No change in control on applications. And we went out to the public forums and talked to hunters. They were very supportive of that. And then you can kind of pick and choose some of these things. On the wildlife side, hunting side, increases not as much. On the fishing side, for instance, on the angling tag and the fishing license, a little bit more of an increase because, frankly, in Oregon, two-thirds of our costs and two-thirds of our program are really fish programs. With all the work we do on salmon, all the work we do with marine fisheries, all the work we do on the east side with trout and other species, we really have a department heavy to fisheries. And, of course, that comes with real costs with all the monitoring, endangered species issues in the Columbia River, coho, bull trout, for instance, those kinds of things. So one of the things that we're doing as kind of a marketing ploy this year is we're going after what we call the Trout 365, because in Oregon, you can fish somewhere for trout 365 days a year. A lot of states don't have quite as large opportunity for this. And so we're using this a little bit to start to tell people about perhaps a change in license fee. But at $38 per year, if you want to go trout fishing, that's $2.38 on the average per trip. And we base that on is from all the survey work we did, the average Oregon angler goes fishing about 16 times a year. And so when you break down that $38 license fee, that's $2.38 every time they go out fishing. Which, if anyone here has been fishing lately, $2.38, that's probably one of your least amount of all your costs when you go fishing for a day. And if you go to Buoy 10, that's a cup of coffee. So that's one way we're looking at this. Go ahead, Debbie. Want to move through this? That wraps it up, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair. We know we got a lot of issues here today, and we just wanted to give that overview. I know we'll have lots of discussion in this committee.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Esquivel.
I knew sometime when I turned 65 that you would figure a way to get money from me for my Pioneer license, Roy. The other thing is I suggest that the commission or the department itself look into this. I think the state of Pennsylvania, they have quite a graph that when they would raise for fees, less people would hunt and fish. When they would lower fees, more people would hunt and fish. We're eventually going to head for a train wreck in this state if we're not careful, because you're going to get it at the point where the only people who are going to be able to go hunting of a family of four, it's going to cost them an arm and a leg, and you can't do that to the working people.
One quick one.
Representative Krieger.
Roy, do you know how many Pioneer licenses are issued a year?
Yes, sir. I think it's about 53,000.
Okay.
Wow.
53,000 a year, and that is going up as the population ages and fishermen. So you can see where we're going on this,
yep.
Representative Krieger. I mean, this 53,000 this year. Now, in a few years, it probably easily be 60,000, and about half of those licenses, I'm not getting any federal excise tax money for. But it's a little complicated. We'll be happy to have a long discussion about that. I know, for instance, there's a lot of folks that are in their early 60s all looking forward to that Pioneer license. But a lot of information we're going to provide on that. But it's
we'd like to know what that's going to bring us.
Yes, sir. We'll be able to do all that. Thank you.
Mr. Director, I don't know whether it's just the members of this committee or whether it's age or what it is, but there's nothing to fear about giving them a free go. I mean, you know, there's plenty left for the rest of us. So, Representative Whitsitt.
Yes, I'm hearing from a lot of my constituents that they are giving up hunting and fishing because of the increase in licenses, and I was wondering if you're seeing a decrease over the last few years in licensing for hunting and fishing. I mean, you know your numbers from one year to the next. Yes, is it down or up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, in the last 5 years, I'm happy to say it's not been going up, but it's not been going down. It's been relatively flat. We have all those numbers we can provide to you about numbers of hunting and fishing. But it's not been a significant decrease at all. It's been relatively flat. We have about 650,000 fishermen and about 280,000 hunters generally. But we'll provide you that information here this week.
Okay.
And you can take a look at it yourself.
And I just want to say that if I'm doing my math right, your fishing licenses, it's a 25% increase through 2020 and 40% on your angling tag.
Mr.
Just to break it into
sure.
what the percentages are versus just looking at some money there. So.
Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what's it? Thank you. Again, I'm sure there'll be lots of discussion on this fee proposal, a lot of discussion individually and ways and means and probably this committee too.
Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yeah. I'd like to call up, please, Stan Steele, L. Elkins, and Joe Rollator. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I'm here today to talk about the fee increase from ODFW. We were and are a member of EBAC, the External Budget Advisory Committee that you saw up there on the board. When they first met this year, we had the understanding, we came to the realization that there was going to be a request for fees increases. At about that time, they started the town hall meetings, and a number of our members attended those, and we started getting a great deal of feedback against most of those things that you increases that you saw up there in relation to hunting. I'm sure you've all had to deal with comments on the Pioneer license. We did as well. So during that time, the board, through phone calls and emails from membership, decided that they could not support a fee increase, and we testified in front of the commission that the Oregon Hunters Association could not support a fee increase. What we heard a lot was that people were disillusioned about hunting. They also wrapped up fishing in that scenario as well. And many commented on that they were tired of paying for hunting trips and not having the opportunity to even see wildlife, let alone hunt it. So that was the theme that we saw in the emails and the phone calls. And to sum it all up, we got a phrase that stuck with us as hunters do not want more days in the field, but more wildlife in the field. And that, in essence, said gives you the mindset of what these people were saying. So what's next? During the EBAC process, a lot of information was given to us. And if I'm going to say anything today that you're going to remember, I hope it's this, that we have to have a policy discussion at some time here in this building about the field biologists, who we as an association support 100%. Our number one priority, every legislative session I've been with this group, is to keep the field biologists in the field and to keep the game enforcement officers in the field. But something that I learned that was just absolutely astounding to me was that 50 to 60% of the daily work of biologists now includes analysis of agency to agency work including analysis plans at the county, state, and federal levels that impact wildlife and habitat. So this is not your mom and dad's, grandma and grandpa's ODFW that we're all used to. These are not the biologists. These are the biologists that now have a tremendous amount of work to do in addition to the 50 to 60% of time that they have to spend on planning, analysis of plans. So our question is, who's paying for this? Well, we know the answer now, but we'd like to see perhaps a discussion on who should be paying for it and how should they be paying for it. And when you look at 50% to 60% of an individual's time, that takes a lot of time away from wildlife and habitat management that we think we are paying for and that we think we should be getting out of our dollars. And I would conclude with that. So we would like to have, the board would like to have that discussion publicly. It's never been discussed publicly, I don't think. Thank you
very much. And if we could, if you can, 5 minutes maximum, 4 minutes, we might even have time for questions.
He knows you well. He knows you well, Stan.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escobar, committee members. So let's agree with what Al said. I think there's a consensus across the sport user groups, both in the angling, the hunting, the trapping community, that we might not have avoided the train wreck. Or if we have, we're entering the tunnel. And it's a dark tunnel. $34 million potential in the red, up to $132 million potentially in the red in the next 6 years if we don't either shore up the tracks or see what the base problem is. Base problem is participation. Without the hunters, fishers, and other users participating, the economic model doesn't work. It's the North American model of wildlife conservation. It's based on a user pay, user play scenario. Every action that we take, and I have a newspaper article that I wanted to bring just to refer to myself here, is commission votes today on limiting hatchery salmon. Each one of those actions is death by a thousand cuts to our rate-paying public. So what we have to do is have that discussion. Get back to our core values. Understand, as this is so apropos for where we're at. We used to go deer hunting in eastern Oregon and elk hunting. Now we go deer camping and elk camping. There is a root problem. It can't be solved by anything other than looking at those programs that will support our core user groups. Other states are doing it. A recent survey that ODFW participated in, they say is not a good survey, but it was conducted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under a grant with the ODFW, said Oregon has lost 18 and 17% of its hunters and anglers within the last 5 years, respectively. I don't know whether the survey is accurate, but it's certainly out there and published. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport. I've been involved in this sort of thing, fish and wildlife funding, for a long time, 30 years or so. And I'm not going to talk about all the specifics of the percentages of who pays what and where it comes from, but I want to talk about a little bit about the history of how we funded wildlife management in North America. And we developed a informal policy in about the 1830s, where we set forth seven principles, and I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but basically the wildlife belongs to everybody, and that it's hunting and fishing, implied, is democratic, which means anybody who wants to hunt and fish can hunt and fish. It's governed by laws that are set by the governments in the places where we hunt and fish. And sort of unstated was that the consumers, fishermen and hunters, would pay for the management of everything. Us guys that hunted and fished would buy tags like the duck stamp that came out in 1934. And also we pay excise taxes on the hunting and fishing equipment that we buy through the Pittman-Robertson Act that went into effect in 1937, and the Dingell-Johnson Spruceless Restoration Act that went into effect in 1950. And anywhere from 10 to 12% of the wholesale value of fishing and hunting equipment is collected by the federal government and then redistributed back to the states for fisheries management. And just to cut this short, there's a discussion going on about taking the general fund and parceling that's in ODFW's budget and just converting that to conservation and taking the hunting and fishing fees and saying you get to manage deer and elk with that money. And I participated in that conversation for a while, but now I kind of think that maybe it's not a real good conversation for us to have, because we've just kind of changed the North American conservation model to, now we've got to figure out a way so the other people that are enjoying wildlife without eating it can pay. And I think that all of us who hunt and fish are willing to pay as much as we can. For myself, you know, I get a tremendous amount of pleasure out of a $50 or $60 charge for my fishing licenses. And it's a lot less than going and playing a day's golf. But that's just me, and I don't have the same demands economically that some other people have. So I just want to leave you with an idea, that is that if we all as hunters and fishermen had not have paid for fisheries and wildlife management that restored deer and elk populations in Oregon, we wouldn't be having to have the argument about the wolves, because the wolves didn't have anything to eat. If we hadn't have already gone and paid for really good scientific management, if we hadn't held those animals in public trust, and if we hadn't allowed everybody to have access to those animals. So my lecture is over, and as the session goes on, you all know that have worked with me that I really like to have these sort of extended esoteric discussions about these things before we make decisions. And so I hope that you follow that model, and that we have that discussion, and that we come up with an equitable way to continue to fund really good fish and wildlife management. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Real briefly here, you mentioned, we kind of touched on people doing work in our biologists doing work for other people, other organizations, other departments, probably state departments, so on and so forth, and county, state, and maybe even federal, I'm not sure. The one thing that I think we do lack in the, not the commission, but the department, where's the accountability for these biologists that we have? What exactly do they do? What exactly do they produce? If we have someone doing 60% of his work or her work for some county, why aren't we back charging the county? Why aren't we back charging DAS or whomever, ODOT or whomever, for their time that's spent? Because if they didn't grab those biologists, by golly, they'd have to hire somebody.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, that's our question. It's kind of a vicious circle, and we want to see if there was some way we can break that and get them reimbursed for what they're doing. About what they're doing now, we have a very good working relationship with the biologists through our 25 chapters, and they attend all our monthly meetings, and so we know what the work they're doing, and we know how hard they work to maintain the wildlife and the habitat, but we also know all of the additional things that they're called to do. So we just want to get some questions answered is all.
Representative Krieger, and then Representative Reardon.
I think I need to point out that maybe Mr. Rollator's participation rate means that he's paying about 7 cents a day to end it. When you fish 300 some days a year.
364 and a half days a year.
Maybe we should start prorating this thing.
Representative Reardon.
I'm just curious. I didn't capture how much all the increases were on the fees, but the one I remembered was like $5 over 5 years or something. Didn't seem like a whole lot to me, but I can't judge how that might affect somebody else's finances. But do you have any information through your various organizations that talks about how much the average hunter or fisherman, fisher person, spends per year on their recreational activities?
Well, yeah, I'm just,
and where I'm going, obviously, is how big a deal is this $5 a year increase if somebody's spending 50, 100, 200, whatever they spend a year. So just trying to help me put it in perspective.
Chair Witt, Representative Reardon, it's a great question. In my pocket, I have over $250 of licenses and tags to hunt fish in Oregon. So for a family, that can really mount up, especially in family in rural Oregon, where maybe the job isn't really what we'd classify in Portland as a family wage earning pay job. So it does mount up, each little cost. And I'm an exception. I'm like Joe. I hunt and fish a lot. So I'm very willing to pay, and I'm capable of paying. But we really do have to look at those who can't. Participation's declining. That means that obviously rates are going to go up. And so it's difficult for many families. And you look at $2 here, $2 there, $5 here. Pretty soon you're saying, now, do I do this or do I do that? And these are discretionary spending. It's recreational discretionary spending. And that's always the first to go. Hopefully I helped.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, there are studies out there that show how much Oregonians are spending on hunting and fishing, and it's broken down by county and the revenues that are generated through local businesses and things of that nature that really make you become aware of how much families are participating in these sports. So we'd be glad to get that information to you.
I'd love to see it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The one thing I will state, though, that if they don't buy the license, they won't do the rest. They won't go out and buy the equipment. They won't go out and do this. They won't travel. They won't, everything comes to a halt.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, that's very fair. On the average, Oregonian will spend $1,200 a year on his hunting. That's about what it works out. When he's a licensed buyer, he'll spend an additional $1,200. This is not really a cheap sport, and it's difficult. And so, that's where I think incremental increases actually impact.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also like to get the information regarding counties in particular. But I've got to say this, I've lived in my house since 77, my block. There is probably one other person on my block right now who goes fishing. No one does hunting, as far as I can tell. That was not the case when I moved in. It was on a regular basis. The folks across the street from me, the families would go out and go hunting and fishing. And it was not an issue of money. It was an issue of culture, of this is what they did. And the fact is, right now, that's not what's going on. I mean, I always joke that I don't have any farms in my district. I have a lot of chickens. And I do have a lot of chickens. The latest poster that was put on the telephone pole the other day was found white chicken. So Portlandia is not too far from a reality there.
What was his name?
I don't know. They didn't have a name for it. No, it said found. They didn't have. There was no one asking for a white chicken. My point is that there's a cultural change that has taken place. The average Oregonian, in Portland, I think, would have found several hunters and fishing people on my block 30 years ago, 20 years ago. That is not the case anymore. And so the money that's coming in is coming in from a much smaller group of people than we used to have. And in rural communities, that's part of the culture. That's exactly what you do. But in Portland, in the metro area, the folks who are moving into the metro area are not coming from the rural communities of Oregon. They're coming in from outside the state, and they're coming in from urban areas that are not interested, as interested, or knowledgeable about fishing and hunting. So they're not even, they don't even think about a license. In fact, I'd be willing to bet that if I went to talk with most of the, many of the folks in my district, and I would ask them how much a hunting license was, they would want to know what a hunting license was.
Right.
So that's something that we need to recognize, that we have had a cultural change. We need to be able to support the folks who are continuing to do that and enjoy it. I don't do any hunting anymore. I used to. I don't do some fishing when I get a chance to. But we need to really understand that there has been a significant change, and we need to support the people who are still doing it in a way that that also supports the ability for those biologists to do the research and to study and support them when they do the research, even when it comes back the way that you may not want it to.
Yeah, very well said. Thank Absolutely. You. Mr. Chair, Representative, very well said. Thank you. What comes to my mind is a ODFW did a survey, actually a study of the trends that you're talking about, and it was fascinating, and I'll see if I can get that for you.
Please, too. That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah. Professor Rollator, I'm trying to draw conclusions from what you stated, and my mind's going 1,000 miles an hour here trying to get my arms around it. But I think you're suggesting that we do fish and wildlife management. It's not fish and wildlife management. We are managing hunting and fishing, human populations of hunters and fishers. That's what we are managing, I think, is what you were telling me. And I think what you were telling me was is that we sort that out by price, and that by logical extension, what all of you said was that because of that price, I, who can afford it, as Representative Esquivel just said, get to go out and deer camp and elk camp. But my experience, if we keep to this model, is really not that different from the person who we've priced out of the market, because they don't get to hunt or fish, and I don't get to see the animals as Al was alluding to. And so by managing hunters and fishers by price, we have actually sacrificed the experience for those hunters and fishers, and we are not managing fish and wildlife. Now, if that's what you're telling me, then this begs for a pretty significant shift.
Mr. Chair, I think from my own personal standpoint, when I was a kid, fish and wildlife management was hunting and fishing management, but that's not the case anymore. Now, when you manage for hunting and fishing, or the ability to hunt and fish, you have to do a lot of other things. You have to do requirements for other laws so that you can hunt and fish. We found out that there's science that we need to gather in order for us to have sustainable wildlife populations. And we've also started to understand that we need to manage in a holistic manner, that we can't manage meadowlarks and then manage foxes separately, that we need to have some kind of overall management system. I think we're transitioning. and this my point was that the funding crisis is going to cause us to have a discussion as we transition into being able to pay for adequate science and management of all the species that live in Oregon, and that's going to be very expensive, and that somehow hunters are going to say, well, you know, we can't afford to pay for that, and the general public is saying, well, use our general funds for things that we want to send it on. And I think it's a horrible dilemma for us to go through. But I think this body, and you know, you you all have worked together for a year now, and so we all have a pretty good idea how you work. You've been capable of asking those questions, and we'd like to help you find answers to those questions. We're all getting kind of old. We're not going to be here very long, and it'd be nice to leave a place where somebody who wanted to go out and see a fox could see a fox.
I am 15 seconds away from taking you up on your offer. You have 15 seconds to change your mind. I'm not seeing any of you leaving the dais.
No, we're not leaving.
I would like to ask the three of you to work with Beth to form a work group to find those answers.
Thank you. We will. Thank you very much, sir.
With that, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We need some help from some other folks that are interested in this. And so if we might add a few more people, we'd appreciate it.
We have the power of draft here in this case. There's some other people right now that need to be drafted. Yes. The recruiter's right outside the door, by the way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
With that, we're going to shift to comprehensive predator control. And I'd like to call up, please, Ron Anglin and Scott Beckstead. That helped. We'll see.
Good afternoon, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Once again, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. I do have a short PowerPoint presentation for you here that I thought I'd run through real quick. Again, being sensitive to your time, I'll kind of zip through some things. We do, you know, and this is based on some of the input that we've received from you on what you were looking for today. We have had a lot of focus in the last few years on a suite of species. Some of those we've been in front of this committee to discuss in the past, also in front of the Senate Environment Committee to discuss. We'll gloss over several of them right here and then go into more detail on several of the others. You know, as you're all well aware, we've got very liberal seasons on several of our species. We've done everything we can, holding price down on bear tags, cougar tags, and providing multiple opportunities for hunters. Success rates for our hunters on some of these species are not very high, and our ability to manage populations based on that is fairly limited. Wolves, as you're well aware, and we've reported to you before, are coming and are here in the state. We are initiating research in Northeast Oregon on the interaction of wolves, cougars, deer, and elk, and looking at how all of that plays out as wolves reestablish themselves on the landscape, what that does to prey species and populations, and whether wolf and cougar predation is additive or compensatory. We've seen mixed results in some of the other states, and we want to make sure that we've got some really good information from Oregon that can inform us in management decisions as we move into the future. The following three I'm going to touch on a little more detail, so we'll just go ahead and move into those. You're well aware of the discussions that we've been having on cormorants. We are very involved in the Lower Columbia East Sand Island discussions that the Corps of Engineers is undertaking, the EIS they're working on. We're part of, we have cooperator status in development of that EIS and the various alternatives that they have in place. While we do support lethal management of cormorants on East Sand Island, we've also made it very clear we're not interested in cormorants being displaced into other coastal estuaries in Oregon and exacerbating the problem that we may have in some of those other estuaries. We've reported on the work that we've been doing in coastal estuaries, so I won't really go into a lot of detail here on this other than to say that because of the work that the Corps is doing on the Columbia, we still are waiting for analysis of the stomach contents that we've collected for the Tillamook and also for the Rogue and the Umpqua. We were denied a depredation permit for 2014 for the Tillamook. We hope to have enough or have our information back in time to include that in our request for a depredation permit for the Tillamook in 2015. And we've been able to do this work based on the fact that you have provided us funding that we've been able to use as match with our federal funds to be able to conduct the research that we've been working on. What we've seen so far in the diet results in the Tillamook, 6 to 35% of the salmonids are being consumed in the diet of cormorants. We've got a multitude of species that results in about 1 to 4% of the out-migrants annually coming out of the different river systems into the Tillamook. In the Umpqua and the Rogue, the diet composition of salmonids is a little bit different than what we've seen so far in the Tillamook. The picture in the bottom right there is of a picklefish, and that was completely contained inside the stomach of a cormorant. So it was pretty much extended from the trachea all the way through to the bottom of the stomach. And, you know, it's
would
nothing
you call
small.
A picklefish?
I have no clue what a picklefish is. I'm a wildlife biologist. But
oh, I see what they're doing now.
So it maybe Ed can tell you that when he's up here on stock transfer. So next, want to talk to you a little more detail about pinnipeds. We've had Robin Brown here in front of you in the past talking about the programs that we've got. You know, I'll just put in a plug that Oregon's pinniped program is practically the only pinniped program on the West Coast. We are the leaders on providing scientific data and information to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries on sea lion, seals, and other pinniped management. And the decisions that are made in large part are due to the work that our shop does, our very small shop does, and is dependent on ongoing funding, which will be wrapped into our budget request that you'll see this winter. So, you know, we all know that pinnipeds were protected under the Marine Mammal Act back in the 70s. Since that point in time, we've seen substantial increases across the United States in the coastal areas of pinnipeds. We certainly have seen that here in the West Coast. And did want to point out that there is no archaeological evidence that pinnipeds ever went to either Salile Falls on the Columbia or Willamette Falls and consumed salmonids like they are today. That appears to be a learned behavior, and it's something new that was never here historically. We've reported on some of this to you in the past, again, on consumption rates at the various sites. I think that the important part of this is that the work that we've been able to do on the Columbia is what led to our being able to get both hazing and removal of sea lions in the Columbia. And we also, based on things that we're working on right now, are looking at how we can provide the information necessary that would allow us to request for potential removal of sea lions at Willamette Falls. So, you know, there's a lot of work that's been going on. It's been ongoing for a lot of years, and it's been pretty critical to our success in being able to move forward on different things. And the last thing I want to touch on is cougars. Certainly, we feel like we have a very robust cougar population in the state. You know, the question that really came up relative to cougars is in relation to deer and elk. And, you know, as you're well aware, deer and elk and their survivability, their ability to expand, is based on primarily on three different things. You know, it's habitat, disease, and predation. And what we've found here in the state is, by and large, habitat is not a limiting factor for elk. We may be starting to see some problems here in western Oregon, but by and large in eastern Oregon that hasn't been the case. We do feel that habitat is limiting for deer, especially in western Oregon for black-tailed deer. You know, you heard earlier on the Forest Health Initiative some of the things being discussed. Certainly we see on federal lands there are not early successional stage habitats that are conducive for deer, and we've been working with forestry on trying to come up with ways to address that. From a disease standpoint, again, that's not at this point a problem for elk, but it is a concern for deer. And they are different diseases on both black-tailed deer and in mule deer that have cropped up that historically we never had to deal with. And now when drought conditions occur, we end up with losses, not a way that we can actually treat those. And then finally, predation. There's really two ways that predation occurs, and that's either human-caused or that's from what we'll call an actual predator like a cougar. You know, and the human-caused ones, the one I didn't put up here is roadkill. There are a significant number of deer in particular that are killed on Oregon's highways. Poaching is a problem, and we certainly, in our different radio telemetry studies that we've done, when we look at losses of our radio collared animals, we've documented up to 19% of those losses have been as a result of poaching. And in the most recent one, it was the same or virtually the same as the amount of losses that occurred from predation, primarily to cougars. We've had historical studies on deer and elk that have been in that 15 to 20% range on poaching. The legislature has helped out or tried to help out with increased penalties. And, you know, one of the things that we have identified is high road densities and access to animals is really contributing to the ease of people being able to go out and poach. When we find poached animals or radio collared animals, they are not half mile away from a road. They're right next to a road. And in some areas with the road densities that we have, it makes it very hard for those animals to get away and not be easily accessible from somebody that's got a bent for poaching. Hunting seasons. The other way that we can see that I'm going to term predation, you know, we influence populations through our hunting seasons, certainly whether they're damage hunts or they're population level hunts, we can manipulate populations up and down with what we do, primarily through our cow harvest, not through bull or buck harvest, but through cow or doe harvest is how we manipulate populations. The final thing relative to predation is what happens from critters on the ground. Cougar predation, it occurs. And we certainly, you know, we've been a leader in the West on our research relative to cougar management over the course of the last 25 years in documenting predation rates and documenting interaction with cougar and deer and elk and influencing populations. And you know, we certainly as you're well aware and you've heard from us before, we don't manage cougars at this point in time. You know, the amount of hunting that occurs is pretty minimal. The amount of harvest that occurs is pretty minimal. We don't manage cougars as a big game animal to the same level that we manage deer and elk. And we've been working towards getting the tools set in place that would allow us to do that, being able to set management objectives, being able to refine population objectives. And quite frankly, I think we're getting very, very close that we can start trotting some of that stuff out and start setting what we would term to be population objectives for cougars, similar to what we do for deer and elk. And you know, some of our research that just was wrapped up, and I was hoping we'd have more time, I'd be able to touch on that today. You know, we've got some ways now that we feel we can come in and make population estimates at the unit level. They're expensive to do, but we feel like we've got some ways to do that, and we're refining what that might mean, and when we update the cougar plan the next time, how we can trot that out in a way that would allow us to more effectively manage cougars. wanted to show you some of the things that we've done.
Ron, I'm excuse me for interrupting, but can you put a wrap on this?
Yes, sir.
Time.
I've got
again.
Two slides.
Okay. Thank you.
So wanted to touch real quick on the Heppner management area, where we implemented a cougar target area, where we wanted to test the effect of reducing the cougar population and how an elk population would respond. You can see in this slide that the elk population, the green line, had been declining through time. Calf recruitment was declining with that. When we saw the population declining, we responded. We decreased hunting opportunity. We decreased antlerless tags. We decreased bull tags. At the same time, we saw some small increases, but really very little in harvest of cougars. So we implemented a cougar target area where we went in and administratively removed cougars ourselves. And over a three-year period of time, we removed 58 cats. There were another 34 cats that were actually removed by hunters during the same time frame. A couple of those were also on damage complaints. And then we stopped the cougar removal. And what we saw was the population responded in the green line. You can see that it came back up. We increased bull tags. We increased some antlerless tags. And our calf recruitment came up. But now our calf recruitment's starting to decline again. And why is that? Well, as we all suspected, the cougar population rebounded. So we've run some simulations on what that looks like. And we ran three different simulations, our research unit did. And what we looked at with the bottom line here and the diamonds is what happens in a unit if you remove a whole bunch of cougars and there's no new cougars come in. How long, knowing that you only remove maybe 50% of the cats, how long would it take for that cat population to recover? And what we found was by year four, the cat population was starting to bounce back, and by year six, we were back to pre-removal levels. So then we looked at what if we had low immigration levels coming in from adjacent units and then high immigration levels coming in from adjacent units. How soon would we expect to see the cougar population rebound, assuming you had no more cougar removal? And it was anywhere from 2 to 3 years. So that also leads into the whole discussion on managing cougars and managing populations, similar to what we do with deer and elk. Because certainly we could have more deer and elk than what we do. But socially, we look at the habitat, we look at landowner tolerance for those numbers, and we manage below what the carrying capacity is. We don't do that with cougars. And what we need to set the stage for, and what we're setting the stage for, is getting to the point where we can make those choices on we want to manage cougars in conjunction with deer and elk and work for a broad range of values, recognizing we don't want to wipe cougars out. We want to maintain a healthy population of them, but in conjunction with other species. And I'm not going to run through all that. That's it.
All right. Thank you very much. Scott, welcome to our committee. Good to see you.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States, also the Western Regional Director for the Humane Society of the United States, here to speak on the issue of predators. Chair Witt, I sympathize with your time constraints. When I took over as mayor of Waldport, we had a long, sad history of city council meetings that lasted till 2 in the morning, and my first order of business was to get those down to an hour and a half or less. So I'm going to try and make this very brief. I handed out in my materials some biological information about our position on the effects of predators on wildlife species and populations. I would like to add to that just a request that you, whenever you're looking at policy changes regarding predators, that you take into account evolving social trends and attitudes toward predators and where we are now versus where we were, say, 50 or 60 years ago with respect to predators. The trend generally And this is reflected in the fact that more and more of your constituents want predators protected. And moreover, that is enhanced by the fact that predators, more than... That's probably for me. Should I continue?
Please.
The methods used on predators are methods that are not used on other wildlife species. The use of packs of dogs, the use of bait, piles of bait in the forest, steel-jawed leg hole traps, wire snares, large volume killing contests, especially involving coyotes, and spring bear hunts that leave baby cubs orphaned in the woods. Now, the voters have already banned two of those methods, and nationwide we're seeing these methods targeted by voters and by legislatures. And I'm not here to say that the Humane Society wants to ban predator hunting. What I'm saying is that predators deserve the same basic level of respect as every other species. And when you see the kind of images on Facebook and social media and the internet of what people do to predators more than they do to other wildlife species, what that does is it turns non-hunters into anti-hunters. And this conversation about decreasing populations of hunters and decreasing participation, if there was a greater respect accorded to these species, there would be a lot less outrage. And that outrage is inevitably going to turn into policy, one way or the other. I've always said that if it weren't for cougars and wolves and sea lions, I'd probably have an existential crisis and wouldn't know what to do with myself, at least while I'm in this building. I guess we can add cormorants to that list of rogues. But the Humane Society is very proud to stand for these species, and we believe that they are unfairly scapegoated. And we are encouraging you as lawmakers, as policymakers who care about wildlife, to take an approach that is balanced and fair and humane. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Burning questions. Gentlemen, thank you both very, very much. I'd like to call up, please, Joe Ricker, George Houston, and Stan Steele. Gentlemen, if you can help me, I have one more segment to do after you before 5 o'clock, so do what you can do to help me here manage the time. Thank you.
Like an auctioneer.
Go ahead, Joe.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm Joe Ricker, chairman of the Oregon Hunters Association, chairman of the board of Oregon Hunters Association. I'm going to skip my first paragraph and go to the last three points that I want to make. The first one is the sage grouse. As you know, they're being considered for listing under the Endangered Species Act. The listing of this bird will have an adverse impact on the economy of those regions of Oregon where they occur. Oregon has been able to maintain a viable population of sage grouse, but as indicated by studies, predation is a major factor in the decline of sage grouse across the range. A recent study in northwestern Nevada, not far from home, indicates that over 88% of the nests that were monitored were depredated. In another study done in the very recent past, they showed that 94% of the nests were depredated. The solution for sage grouse management is a balanced approach with management of a habitat and depredation. That's very short of what I intended to say, so I'll move on to elk and deer. Elk and deer numbers have declined in many areas over the last several years. There are studies that indicate high predation densities explain the overwhelming majority of variations in calf to recruitment. Cougars kill about 1.55% more ungulates in summer than in winter because they are killing the elk calves and the deer fawns. This is needed to meet their nutritional requirements,
I think.
The fact that more kills in summer results is that there's about 75% of the elk killed during the summer are, in fact, the calves, and about 40% of the 6% of the deer that are killed in the summer are fawns. This flies in the face of the old wives' tale that they kill the old and the inflamed ungulates. In fact, they're killing the future of the ungulates. In this same study, it states that in the past 10 to 15 years, the calf-to-cow ratios at the end of the winter was below the level needed to maintain elk populations in northeast Oregon. My next point. ODF&W implemented a mule deer initiative a few years ago, and we applaud them for doing so. You saw part of their results on what happens when you remove predators in a region. There's indications that this is not only the only unit where predator removal has assisted the deer populations, and I applaud them for doing that. All of the declines cannot be attributed to predation. However, predation management is action that can and should be taken in the short term to assist in maintaining and enhancing wildlife numbers in Oregon. Chair Whit, that's about as quick as I can make it.
You did an excellent job. Thanks for the help. Truly appreciated.
Chair Whit, members of the committee, my name is George Houston. I'm the president of the Oregon chapter of the Foundation for North American Wild Sheep.
Welcome.
Thank you. This morning, when the sun came up in the state of Oregon, in Wallowa County, we had 12 herds of Rocky Mountain Bighorn sheep, a real success story. Likewise, we have 32 herds of California Bighorns in the state of Oregon today. The staff and the employees, the bios on the ground in different parts of the state are doing really, really good work for Bighorn sheep and the places they habitate. We've got a really good opportunity for hunters that we want to see continue. Interestingly enough, by 1912, there were no California Bighorn sheep in the state of Oregon. In 1954, ODFW went to British Columbia and brought back 22 head of California Bighorn sheep. And they took them to Harp Mountain National Antelope Refuge in southeastern Oregon, and they released them. Did absolutely a superb job. By 1992, we had 600 individual sheep on Harp Mountain. Fast forwarding to last year, we have 168. It appears that cougar predation on the Harp Mountain National Antelope Refuge is reducing the amount of bighorn sheep markedly. We'd like to see the agency look really, really hard at the cougar predation challenge there and once again get into the predation management process. It's important that we consider managing the predation rather than eliminating the predation. It's got to be a balanced approach. We've got terrestrial, aquatic, and aerial predators in the state of Oregon that require our attention. All the counties require that kind of help from time to time. We need to have management objectives set. We need a balanced management process. We need projects on the ground to manage predators with metrics to match to help our rural economies come back to where they used to be in times gone by. If you drive Highway 101 and you start in Lincoln City and just head north to Astoria and you go by the river drainages and you look at the little old places that are run down and closed that used to be cafes and they used to serve meals every day to fishermen or hunters, And you kind of wonder, gee, what would happen if they had more hunter opportunity or fisher opportunity in those locations? Do you think things could change? I think maybe that's something we ought to consider. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today and would look forward to working with you folks in the future.
George, let me get those figures again. Sometime in the 1990s, Heart Mountain, we went sheep population
600.
From...
In 1992, from zero in 1912 mm-hmm. to 1954, when the agency transplanted the sheep from Williams Lake, British Columbia, 22 sheep, by aggressive support of the animals on the ground, we had over 600 sheep by 1992. If you fast forward to today, we had 168 total sheep population on Heart Mountain last year. Predation isn't the only challenge here. Understood. I'm not trying to paint that picture.
Understood.
But they need some help, and we need to kind of look at that process and say, what can we do to swing in and make things, once again, balanced out?
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, committee members, I'm going to make this really quick. I handed out a relatively lengthy handout that talks about what we really would like to see in Oregon. And the reason I'm going to make it quick is we have another really important discussion coming up. So if you'll take the time to read that, and what I would request is if you do have questions, please get a hold of us. We really are working on this issue daily, and I mean daily. It's a 24/7 almost sometimes issue. It's that important to Oregon's future wildlife. We're not anti-predator. If there's a person who is a conservationist and a hunter and says he's anti-predator, he's neither. In other words, management, professional, science-based management. And with that, we'd like to see a policy, statewide policy administered by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, a directed policy by the legislature, however, and setting up a funding source and a review that allows us to have professional science-based management. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Burning questions. Gentlemen, thank you. Truly appreciated. Thank you for helping out with the time factor as well. Call up next, please, Bill Bakke and Ed Bowles. Salmonid stock transfer policy. Welcome to our committee, gentlemen.
Thank you. Chairman Witt and members of the committee, my name is Bill Bakke, representing the Native Fish Society. And we presented a concept to the committee, and I believe that you have that in your possession to look at developing a bill for controlling stock transfers of salmon and steelhead and other fish in the state of Oregon. And I want to address that the purpose for our concern and give you some scientific foundation for it, which I've also supplied. There's a lot of it available. I only gave you a couple pages of it, but there are quotes from scientific literature that are actually studied the issue and have, going way back to the 1930s, have said that, you know, locally adapted salmon and steelhead populations, in order to maintain their abundance and productivity, they need to be managed as a individual stock. And what that would suggest is that you don't move fish from one watershed into another watershed. And the science behind that question is coming more and more clear all the time, that if you're going to maintain the genetic diversity and life history diversity of your locally adapted animal that's adapting to continuous changes in the environmental circumstances, both in the ocean as well as in fresh water, that those fine-tuned adaptations can be disrupted by the inclusion of naturally spawning stocks from another watershed, especially a more distant watershed, or a hatchery fish that has been cultivated and released into a watershed to free to spawn with salmon of wild origin, locally adapted origin. The science is pretty clear on that, and it's getting more clear all the time. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife scientists have identified this as a problem, and in some cases, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has been very responsive in trying to solve that problem. A good example of that would be on the Clackamas River. Non-native summer steelhead were released above North Fork Reservoir. ODFW scientists looked at that issue, found that the winter steelhead, which are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, were actually declining as a result. They were able to show as a result of releasing summer steelhead. Summer steelhead produced juveniles that competed with wild summer or winter steelhead juveniles. And as a result, the production of wild winter steelhead decreased by about 50%. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, recognizing this problem, removed the release of hatchery summer steel above the dam, not below the dam, but above the dam, and they're no longer able to pass up the fishway to above the dam and reserve that for a wild fish sanctuary, and that population has begun to grow. So that's an example. Also on the Imnaha on the Grand Ronde River, once those Chinook were listed, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife took non-native salmon out and went to a local broodstock. They identified six different spring Chinook in the Grand Ronde River, different stocks that are adapted to various parts of the watershed. And they decided to work with them instead of bringing fish in from Wind River down in the Columbia River Gorge. So those are good indications that the department is following the literature, the science, and is also following the lead, the information and recommendations of their staff. But it's not always the case, and that's the problem. It's kind of a situation where if it doesn't fit with our fishery goals, then we're not going to do manage the program so that it's actually benefiting and protecting the life history diversity of the wild population. An example of that, for instance, is on the Santiam River. Another one is on the Molalla River. Another one's on the Nakanakum River. We're in a case where they're bringing fish in from other watersheds, releasing them. There's competition influence. There's predation, attraction, and predator influence of those stockfish. Now, like, for instance, on the Santiam River, they've asked people to come in and catch the residual summer steelhead, hatchery summer steelhead, that are not native to the Santiam River and are competing with wild winter steelhead that are threatened under the Endangered Species Act, to come and fish for those juvenile steelhead that are residualized, those hatchery steelhead, so that they would reduce the competition between the juvenile hatchery steelhead and the wild winter steelhead. Well, the problem is that problem is not getting, that isn't a good way to resolve the problem because you're also impacting wild steelhead at the same time. But the thing is that the fish don't belong there. But why are they there? Because they sell fishing licenses. That's an important thing to the agency. I understand that. But at the same time, why are we allowing summer steelhead be released in that watershed that are known competitors and making a problem in the Santiam when we didn't do it, where we made those changes, crucial changes, on the Clackamas above the dam? So those inconsistencies are the problem. And it's not a one thing, fixes the whole problem. There's a lot of problems that these fish are faced with. The problem is that the stock transfer policy, which was repealed on the Oregon coast, established by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife in the 1980s to protect native spring Chinook, they repealed it when they adopted their coastal multi-species plan in order to allow hatchery introduction of spring Chinook from the Rogue River into the Yaquina and Coos Bay. We don't know what the impact of those fish are going to be, but the reason they decided not to adopt a stock transfer policy for the coast was to protect the naturally rearing, productive Chinook populations on the Oregon coast. That was the goal. Now we've repealed it. So again, the science is clear that we need to protect these locally adapted stocks. The stock transfer policy It doesn't exist in the state of Oregon by rule. It doesn't, but it is supported by the rules, but it doesn't exist as a rule. It's supported by state law, prevent the serious depletion of any indigenous species, but it doesn't exist as a requirement under state law not to transfer these fish and protect these fish. Most of which are listed as threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. That's an obligation, recover those species. Transferring fish from one watershed or a hatchery into another one doesn't help you accomplish that objective, as on the Santiam and the Mullala River and others. So the point I'm trying to make is that the science is clear on stock transfer. Don't do it. If you can avoid it, don't do it. The department has been compliant with the science in some cases, but not in all. And we have species recovery problems that aren't being addressed by the state that should be, but are being frustrated by stock transfer policy not being applied to those situations. So the goal is, under this legislation, I think we've written it, our concept, broadly enough where it would allow some transfer of fish. For instance, I said to the, you know, in my comments that bringing bull trout in from the Metolius, which certainly is an adjacent watershed to the Clackamas, but it helped to recover bull trout that had gone extinct in the Clackamas. Maybe it's not a good choice, but they seem to be doing well. And they are feeding on ESA listed salmon and steelhead, you know. But you know that's what happens when you get the feds and the states arguing over what's the proper species and what should the recovery program look like. But we supported bull trout inclusion in the Clackamas River because they used to be there. Okay, so Our policy concept allows for some use of transferred fish, but it really draws a line about moving fish from hatcheries or distant watersheds into other watersheds for release, just primarily for the purpose of creating a sport fishery or a commercial fishery, without monitoring of that release and criteria as to how you're going to manage that release and those interactions between those two kinds of fish, so that you can evaluate whether or not they're actually providing you with a benefit, and the cost of providing that benefit isn't the expense of the native population. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Ed.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today about the stock transfer issue and our policies for both conservation and related to moving fish around between basins. Before I do, I thought I'd just follow up on our wildlife administrator's pickle on the fish in the cormorant's belly.
Yes.
I had not seen that before, but if I were to guess, I would think, I think I love this. It's actually not a pickle fish, if I heard that right. It's a monkey face prickle back. And those are kind of a... you'll have to Google that one. It's more of an eel-looking fish that resides in the rocks and seaweed. And, in fact, they can actually live out of water for a little bit, and the cormorant probably got it when it was stranded due to a tidal shift in the rocks there in Tillamook Bay. So there's a little bit of an anecdote
right.
go for you.
They're all Democrats or Republicans.
So once again, I want to just stress on the outset that ODFW takes, and I did provide some written testimony for you, and hopefully I can be brief and given your time allotments, but you've got that with some details. But we take very seriously the importance of managing
exactly
the risks that are associated with moving fish between basins, whether hatchery fish or naturally produced fish. Those risks are real, and they're very important for us to be aware of and to manage. And those can be genetic issues. They can be health issues related to disease, pathogens, parasites. They can be ecological issues, competition, predation, all of those, both on native fish and wildlife of the watersheds. So that does not, I don't want to imply that there's any management vacuum there whatsoever. I want to also make it clear that we have existing policies in place that allow us to manage for these risks appropriately. And those policies are the Native Fish Conservation Policy, the Fish Health Management Policy, and the Hatchery Fish Management Policy. And all of those basically mandate the requirement of protecting our naturally produced native fish, and within that protective atmosphere, providing opportunities for fishing wherever appropriate within that, standing on that platform of conservation. And we don't do that very effectively with one-size-fits-all sort of policy constraints. And so the Native Fish Conservation Policy is very clear on this, that you achieve that through a portfolio of actions that are custom tailored to the specific situation, whether it be a particular watershed or a particular species. And that's what allows us to meet the conservation needs on a case-by-case basis and allows us to meet the fishing opportunity mandates on a case-by-case basis. And that is the approach that we have taken in dealing with stock transfers, no different than any of the other approaches that we take to managing the risks that are out there relative to our conservation needs. And I want to make it sometimes providing a fishery with an out-of-basin stock is actually less of a conservation risk than using the in-basin stock. And this is typically not the norm, and in fact, our default is to always rely on locally adapted stocks wherever we can. But for example, if you're going to provide a fishing opportunity through a hatchery program, and the local population, in case being on the Nakanakum River Fall Chinook, is not robust enough, and probably never was, to support taking adults out to form a brood stock for that hatchery program, using an outside stock to provide that fishery opportunity is appropriate and less conservation risk than mining the wild fish to get your hatchery brood stock. Other examples would be where you have a situation where a locally derived brood stock moved into the hatcheries may be more likely to interact on the spawning grounds with the remaining wild fish. And so you can isolate the hatchery program by having a stock that is less similar to the local population, and you can actually reduce the interaction effects of that. And then in some cases, we manage to that. And so this really does not lend itself to a one-size-fits-all approach to managing the conservation risks. And I want to just give you a few in my written testimony. I think I gave you 10 examples. If you were to decide to go with a uniform prohibition on stock transfers, I gave you 10 examples of very important fisheries that could potentially be lost by something like that if we weren't able to look at this on a case-by-case basis, which is the way we do it now. And I'll just mention some of the first five on there just to make the point. We'd lose potentially the hatchery Fall Chinook fishery in the Nakanakum River, very important to the North Coast folks. Loss of several hatchery winter steelhead fisheries on the North Coast. And some of these fisheries are very popular between Thanksgiving and December. Before we've shifted to a local broodstock, wild broodstock winter steelhead fisheries in many of our Nestucca, Wilson, some of those rivers. We've lost through those that important Thanksgiving to Christmas time period. And many of our stakeholders really want that traditional fishery that comes from, let's say, an Alsea stock hatchery program. And so managing that to provide that opportunity is very important to stakeholders. We, on the other hand, need to manage those fisheries to ensure that the conservation risks to the wild populations are manageable, are contained. You're never going to reduce that to zero, but you contain it to a manageable level, and that's what we do through our programs. And those were approved through the Coastal Multispecies Plan that the Commission just adopted in June. Loss of several hatchery summer steelhead fisheries on the North Coast. Loss, as Bill mentioned, of several new coastal spring Chinook programs that were part of the Coastal Multispecies Plan to generate economics in the springtime for the likes of the Aquinnah Bay and Coos Bay, as well as ramping up some of the releases in the springtime for the Tillamook Bay. Very important economically to those areas. We believe we can manage those hatchery programs in a way that contains the risks to make sure our conservation needs are met, but we don't need to exclude those from occurring as important economic boosts to those communities. And then the other one that's very important, nearly all of the state's hatchery programs are non-indigenous fish, okay? They're hatchery stocks, Heinz 57. A uniform prohibition on stock transfers would functionally remove the state's hatchery trout fisheries. The reason Bill mentioned that we removed the existing rule that dealt with stock transfers for coastal Chinook, that was limited to just Chinook and it was limited to just coastal rivers. And the reason that was scrubbed, so to speak, was because the case-by-case approach was embodied in the new policies, the native fish policy, the hatchery fish management policy, and the fish health policy. And so it didn't create a vacuum whatsoever. It just allows us the flexibility to deal with this on a case-by-case basis to meet our conservation needs. And that's why that was scrubbed. It was supported. That removal of that in the commission process as well. And so I just want to leave you perhaps with the message that the risks associated with moving fish around are real. We don't take those lightly, but those are embodied in existing policies that are the policies of the state. We are able to contain those risks effectively through management. And by doing that, with the flexibility afforded to us, we can optimize both conservation and fishing opportunities as opposed to a one-size-fits-all uniform prohibition. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your presentations. Appreciate your helping me to get us out of here on time. Committee members, we're 2 minutes over. I want to take a couple of limited questions, and then we're going to need to wrap up. Representative Krieger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Bill, and we really, I think, in 13, coming in, got to understand the value of our native wild fish and that a lot of our effort should be to understand their value and protect them. But at the same time, we understand that straying takes place anywhere from 3 to 8% in wild fish in certain years, and we don't understand why they stray. So why is a wild fish that strays into a stream not as great a same threat as a wild fish from a hatchery that strays into a stream?
Well, this under the scientists have called that a metapopulation. It's usually adjacent streams, and it's part of their life history diversity. So the stray rate may be low, but the fact is that that allows a group of fish to constantly refresh, I guess, genetically. The watersheds, each of the watersheds, because of the strays among the adjacent watersheds, the fish are most different when they're further away. And there's some science that shows you where that distance might be and related to genetic evaluation of the stocks in both places. But the close-by ones are part of the metapopulation. That's the way they've evolved. That's an important aspect.
I think, Mr. Chair, that's the point I'm getting at.
Yes.
This is a natural ongoing thing of non-selective of a wild fish not to select their home stream. it's part of the process, like they come back and 2, 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old fish. It's a safety net. So how we do those stock transfers, as you said, Ed, we need to keep it, when it's necessary, as close to the other stream as possible. We have the same thing taking place from the Klamath to the Rogue, from the Chetco to the Windchuck, from the Windchuck to the Smith River. Wild fish showing up at each of those streams because they didn't go home to their home stream, but they're wild. So it is a natural process that has value, I think, for the fish themselves.
Just the one comment I have about that is when your hatchery fish are selected for essentially called a domesticated fish within a hatchery program, their fitness, their reproductive success is pretty low in the natural environment. And when they interbreed or have an ecological impact upon wild fish in that particular stream, then you cause yourself problems in terms of lowering the production, like they found on the Clackamas, of the fish that were native to that watershed.
Ed, I am curious, when the department's making the decision of where to introduce fish in or to stock them, is there an opportunity for folks like Bill and the Native Fish Society and maybe members of the public who have a scientific interest to be able to have some input into the decision of what fish stocks are being introduced into any given tributary?
Yeah, sure. Wait, let me just give you an example using the coastal plan that was just recently adopted by the commission. We call that, the long name is the Coastal Multi-Species Conservation and Management Plan. It was 6 species mm-hmm. along the coast. You all heard a lot about the public process. There was a lot of sausage making going on throughout a couple year process, and many important stakeholder groups involved in that. We had 4 stakeholder teams. We had a separate habitat scientific forum. We had reviews by the independent multidisciplinary science team, and we had opportunity for public comment throughout the process, opportunity for a 2-step commission, 2 different commission meetings before it was approved, all culminating in unanimous support by the commission and strong stakeholder support in the balanced portfolio. Nobody was happy with everything. But it was supported overall because of that balance of conservation and use that we provided. And I want to make it clear that, for example, that plan, we cannot go in now and unilaterally, as an agency, add fish to a separate watershed and dump and stir. We can't do that. It has to, any changes to those plans now have to have commission review. If we're adding new hatchery programs or moving fish around, so the plan adopted the details, which included several places where there will be stock transfers, and those were fully vetted through the process, and many, many places where stock transfers are prohibited. And that's why a one-size-fits-all doesn't work, because it's across that spectrum that you get to your conservation need by balancing that. And that's locked in for a decade.
You anticipated my next question. Very good.
Well, you addressed it to him. I was a party of this, and I'd like to also say something. Is that I've been working with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife since the 70s, right? And I have to say that administratively, I could address the problems administratively with the biologists and with the management and actually gain some ground in terms of conservation management for fish, which is my primary concern. Right now, frankly, the best way to gain ground is to go to court. And I think that's a waste of time and money. And what we're not finding in the term and within Fish and Wildlife Department is that we're getting the cooperation that he espouses. It's not there. And in fact, our organization and members of our organization working in places like the John Day and the South Coast and so on have actually been blackballed by the agency. And it's one of the reasons that they blackballed us because we took them to court. And we won, according to the judge. But that's important, I guess. But the thing is, I'd rather see the agency do the changing, not have a federal judge tell them to do the changing. But if we're stuck in this role right now, that only you can't solve problems administratively. You have to go to the court. Then we're headed in the wrong direction.
I for one would agree with you that resorting to litigation is headed in the wrong direction. I'm not able to resolve this difference at this point, but I can't speak for everyone on this committee, but I sense a general feeling that there is a desire for us to keep native stocks as pure as we possibly can, to minimize inter-watershed transfers of stocks, that all of this has very sound science and I think makes perfectly good sense to most of us on this committee. But I'm hearing also from the department that there are practical considerations on a daily basis. And to the extent that over the next couple of months, at least prior to December, if there remains problems that need to be addressed through legislation, helping us to better understand how we get past the practical everyday considerations that Mr. Bowles laid out for us, you need to help us understand that, because we're going to be looking, quite frankly, at the possibility of committee legislation between now and then.
Could I say one more thing, please?
Certainly.
And maybe you ask a very important question, and Mr. Bowles lays out an interesting problem. We were concerned about balancing, you know, utilization and protection, conservation and utilization. So we asked the Oregon Department of Justice for a clarification. Mr. Bowles asked for a clarification in 2003 with regard to the native fish conservation policy while we were working on that, and I was on the advisory committee for that. And in both cases, they were consistent. But it's really interesting to note is that the prevent the serious depletion of any indigenous species. A quote is, the commission and the department's overriding obligation is to manage to prevent the serious depletion, which thereby enables the commission and the department to provide optimum recreation and aesthetic benefits. It's not a balancing. You don't have fish if you don't practice conservation. If you don't protect the species, you run out of species, and you have extinction. The fish runs in the state of Oregon, Washington, and California are going extinct. We're losing capacity. And it's not just habitat that's driving them there. It's also fish management. And I would like to say that the Department of Justice, maybe it's worthwhile asking them to give the committee some direction on really what the rule says. This is state law. This is ORS 496.012.
I understand the implication of what you've said. I'm not going to be looking for another branch of the government to direct our committee, but I understand the implication of your suggestion, and their input is certainly welcome. Mr. Bowles, if you have something else, I am absolutely going to have to adjourn this committee here momentarily.
Chair Witt, thank you. I'll just leave you with the fact that we in no way compromise our conservation mandate and its primacy within our management. But it's on that platform of conservation that we provide opportunities for societal use. And conservation does not mean managing to zero risks. It means managing those risks accordingly, and that's what all of our criteria and standards do. and it's always within that context that we provide fishing opportunities, some of which may include, in a very limited basis, some stock transfers afforded that flexibility.
Thank you very much. And with that, gentlemen, you're excused. I appreciate your input. Committee members, just a couple of things here. First, thank you for hanging in here for a very long day. Number two, I will be looking for volunteers to serve on the fact-finding group that we discussed earlier today. And number three, if any of you have concepts for committee bills for December, please let me know as soon as possible. With that, we stand adjourned. And thank you, committee members, very, 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 very. With that, we stand adjourned. And thank you, committee members, very, very.